Bob, what did you ring us for, Bob?
Yes, years ago I lived in Woodford and they turned the cinema into a three-screener and I went past it one day and I remember it said, 10 gremlins escaped from Alcatraz.
You're kidding.
No.
You're kidding. We'll have to carbon date this.
Absolutely brilliant.
10 gremlins escaped from Alcatraz?
10
fantastic.
Gremlins escaped from Alcatraz.
How top of the shop is that, Bob? Now, there's nothing you can do with that information at all, but you do feel like running up to the first person you meet saying, come look at this.
Yes, I know. In fact, I was in the car and nearly had an accident when I saw it, you know.
And, of course, the cinema could have arranged them in their the mini-plexes there as Escape from Alcatraz, Escape from Alcatraz, Gremlins and 10.
No, but 10
Gremlins Escape from Alcatraz. Yeah. And they are, you know, not that I doubt your story in the first place, but of course they were all out at the same time. That is perfectly feasible. But,
The Crazy World of Arthur Brown.
Arthur Brown's Kingdom Come, as they became, were pretty hit between sort of 70 and 73. They did lots of stuff as well. They made about three albums worth a fortune now.
Well, I was at a party in Lewis, and he got up and started singing rock and roll songs the other week. I think it was him.
I think, you know, Lord Sutch, who hasn't gone, by the way, Lord Sutch, who got too much attention away from Arthur Brown, and of course, Arthur is too polite to point out people like Alice Cooper right the way through to Slipknot, probably lent on his act a bit.
Right.
Although Screaming Jay Hawkins would then turn to Arthur and say,
I think Arthur was the one off, though. He was a sui generis, as they say.
Sui generis, was he really? I'll put that to him next time I meet him, because occasionally you run across him. When we was doing TFI Friday, he was on with one of these groups who thought it'd be good to have him there with the ashtray on his head with the flames going on. And the thing is, it had a strap under the chin. I always thought that ruined that effect. It actually had a leather strap. If ever his phone made a leather strap, give me a light.
He was the fire officer's nightmare, wasn't he?
Yeah, and we had to have all that in rehearsal. And he's an extra nice bloke. I mean, he's about 6'6", and he knows the score.
He was a great singer. I mean,
a tremendous tone.
Because I was to go on and sing Leonard Cohen after him.
Oh, I could see that.
Has anyone had Leonard Cohen?
Yeah, Leonard went very early, especially after that last album, 10 Songs, which was one of the best of last year.
Yeah.
So Arthur was on, and he obviously had a little float. So this is good, the kids love you again. He got in touch with his people and said, bring up TFI Friday and see if they want the band back. And I swear to God, it's a true story. So the bookers got this call, and about 18 didn't know, you know. And I represent Arthur Brown. He was on last week with whatever group was sampling his song, and he was on live. And Arthur wondered if you'd like the Crazy World of Arthur Brown on. And so he didn't know who Crazy World of Arthur Brown was, this kid. And he looked at me, who was by far the oldest person on TFI Friday, and said, Crazy World of Arthur Brown, do we want them? And I just said, as a gag, I just said, ask them if they're still crazy, right? And so he went, are they still crazy? And the PR person, knowing that the booking depended on her answer, said, if anything, they're even crazier. That conversation took place. And I think on the tour it should have said, Crazy World of Arthur Brown, if anything now, even crazier.
Well, I have to report, Arthur wasn't all that crazy. He was a very good singer, but he's rather a nice chap and hardly crazy at all.
His career was Shanghai by the one hit, of course. That's what we want. Yeah. No, we don't want your ballads, your sensitive stuff. Put the flaming pot on your head and give it to us straight. And by the way, my little accent there, is there other phone in this morning? Have you ever affected a foreign accent for whatever reason? Did you have to pretend? You tried to be exotic? Did you try to be American? Have you ever?
You're always trying to be American. You're always doing American.
Anecdotally, I'm to visit, might help the story, give it a little heat. But I'm talking about people in private life. All kinds of people go, yeah, baby, I'm from New York, you know. Mm-hmm. And when you're about 16, I tried a couple of accents. I've done posh in Carolina.
Really?
Yeah, because they thought I was Australian. And we were two girls who worked at the Chick-fil-A. And they said, speak like a Londoner, and I've been talking like this. I said, well, this is it. I mean, no, it's not. No, it's not. You know, like Prince Charles did. I said, oh, no. I said, this is a London accent. That's not. It's Australian. And then one of you said, the English accent is so sexy. And all of a sudden I went, well, you see, the thing is, in London, we tend to, darling, you know, my father was George Sanders. And I just, plenty of accent. And you've given us an accent?
I did that when I went to American College. I was,
well, did you really? You became charming, did you?
And I smiled. I've heard this thing that,
There's a grain of truth in that.
Yeah.
There's a grain of truth.
There's a small grain of truth.
All I'm saying is I never miss an opportunity to eat at the Chick-fil-A these days. Thank you very much indeed. Here's somebody. Oh, hang on. Look. Sorry, we're coming to the showbiz news. Yeah. I mean, one second. Jamie in Stepney. Jamie?
How you doing, Ben?
Good as old, Jamie. Now, Jamie, this is your true accent, I take it, I'm hearing now, but in the past?
Yeah, Ben, I had to put on a moody American accent to get myself out of trouble.
What did you do?
What happened was then, was this was about 10 years ago.
See, I could do a pretty good one, but I don't think you can. Go on, Jamie.
This is how it happened then.
Yeah.
About 10 years ago, me and my mate was out in America. We was in San Francisco, and we was working out there, and we shouldn't have been. You know, you got to
Oh, I see, of course, yeah.
The green car, don't you?
Yeah, I know, yeah. But, and?
Well, anyway, we're up on the roof.
Yeah.
And we're
roofing out there, were you?
Yeah.
The previous caller wants your autograph. And? What?
So we're up there, all of a sudden, then it was a quiet street,
yeah.
And a cop has walked along. You know, in all that black, sinister gear.
Yeah, very impressive.
And in the holster, yeah. All that.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, I suppose he's bored, he's engaged me in conversation.
All right, okay.
If I answer normal, then,
yeah.
He's going to know I'm a foreigner, and it could be. Come down, where's your green card, all this.
Okay, so we set the scene here. Now, I'll be the copper, and you do what you did. What did he say to you? First off, what did the copper say?
Well, he started off saying it was a right hot day.
Okay, so he says, so you be you, and I'll be the policeman. Now, you're a roofer, you're from Stepney, you're in San Francisco working illegally.
Yeah.
And the copper comes along and says, I mean, forgive my accent here, but he says, how you doing, buddy? Could it be any hotter? And you said?
I went to him, yeah, it's a hot one.
And
that's where it was going, Dad, and it went on for a little while. But the real thing to it then was he's gone to me, hey, he said, I know that accent. I thought, oh no, he's Stepney.
Yeah. So
I've then gone, oh yeah? Then, as he was about to answer me, this truck come rumbling past. It had all this clattering gear on it.
At least you called it a truck, not a lorry, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a truck, it's out of America, isn't
it? Yeah, of course, yeah.
So, he said it then, and I didn't hear what he said. I'd have given anything to know where he reckoned I came from.
Oh, I see.
Oh, and I didn't hear him. And I just went to him, yeah.
I know what he said. He said, buddy, you're from the Isle of Dogs, aren't you? Well, I want you to say the following phrase in your best American accent, right?
Of course.
When I say now, you've got to say, New York, 1940. Boy, those were the days, all right? New York, when I say now, you've got to say, New York, 1940. Boy, those were the days. Okay, so, hang on.
Right. Boy, 1940.
Yeah,
slightly more like Terry Christian at the end.
It's like the throat on it a bit, but nevertheless, yeah, it's a hot one, ain't it? That's what it is. Here's yet something else from the CD sent to me by Mr. Selman, over in, I think it was in Essex. No letter involved, just these addresses. And just before we go over, listen to this for a tremendous vocal performance. I mean, all I know is it's by Slam Stewart. And listen to this for something. It's from Annie. It is Tomorrow from Annie. But have you ever heard of
this? My favorite.
What a version, ladies and gentlemen. You know, if you want to burn CDs and send them, we will play them, because in this age of pre-manufactured pop, etc., the collapse of pop idol, yes, your big brother, we've got to fight back and show the kids there's another way, and this is the way. Just a little bit more. Here we go, too. Stephen Wright. Today's Stephen Wright. Should I do Stephen Wright? I can't do Stephen Wright's voice. Even with Stephen Wright. Babies, they don't need a vacation, but I still see them at the beach. That kind of annoys me. When no one's looking, I'll go over to a baby and say, what are you doing here? You haven't worked a day in your life. I saw my Bette Noire on television yesterday. Who's that? Kate Mordant, who's the BBC Two scheduler. The scheduler of BBC Two, Kate Mordant. as boss-eyed a nitwit as I've ever come across. no, it's the old man, Kate Morden.
There goes that again.
No, Kate Morden, what she did.
Oh, no, trying coattail you all the way up to Radio 2.
The most disastrous decision ever made by, and this is saying something, the most disastrous decision ever made by that legion of pin-headed nitwits who call themselves TV executives in the country, was the Oscars. You know, the Oscars, I told him what happened. The Oscars comes on, it goes on all night, doesn't it? It's a fantastic thing, but it's on all night, so you put a tape in, don't you? And you get up the next morning, and all civilised people agree, you get some hot buttered toast and tea, you close all the windows, you don't go to work, you put on the Oscar tape and watch it as live, as it unfolds. Kate Morden, as boss-eyed and nitwit as you'll come across this year, decides that, and I'm sitting there watching the Oscars for 3 hours, and decides that after 3 hours of the Oscars, the last hour will be on BBC One. And no warning, nothing. All of a sudden, just went to black and said, if you want to continue watching the Oscar coverage, it's over on BBC One now. Here on BBC Two, we're going over to find out Workplace Matters, a film for those... They changed it. And so you didn't get the last hour. And there she was on Points of View, because loads of people wrote to Radio Time, and they must have blunted the edges of that. And there she was in Radio Time saying, well, we felt that it's very important for people to get their workplace space, and BBC One, they had been on there, and it was like, no, you nitwit, leave the Oscars on. Anyway, she's on Points of View again yesterday, because there's something with the snooker been going on, you know, and all this, going over to Kate Morden. There she was, every bit as boss-eyed pinhead as I thought, standing there, sitting there on the television saying, the reason we cancelled all the programmes is because the snooker championship is only once a year. So I'm going, for some of the Oscars. You didn't say that about the Oscars. Some of the Oscars, you pinhead. You get back to university. Get that. Do a course in washing up and get yourself a good job in a cafe somewhere. Kate Morden, my bet noir was on television. And absolutely, it's as if you people don't understand how scheduling works. We miss your programmes about a very good reason. Because they're only on once a year. Anyway, you all love the Open University, don't you? Bye! Off to get the expenses.
Well, that is Delwinton doing Kate Morden.
Good morning, everybody. We're joined this morning by... you work on BBC Two occasionally, of course.
You were
out of that conversation. You were out of the room. It never took place.
This is thanks to Ellie. She was working at an electrical shop a couple of Christmases ago. When this celebrity came in to buy something, when Ellie ran it through the till, it asked for verification of the ID of this celebrity, which apparently happened several times already that day. So this celebrity shouted,
yes,
you shouted, this is outrageous.
Yes.
Your supervisor.
I did.
And the supervisor it was Dixon's, I think.
I went even nuttier in W.H. Smith.
Did you?
But not, there's a slight twist to this, because it was the actual people at Barclay Card, or Visa.
All right. It might have been them, but you seem to take out your wrath on Ellie.
Get on the air here.
Listen, you said, get me the supervisor. Supervisor came over.
Meantime...
You grabbed the phone and yelled at the person on the other end.
That's what I told him.
And then you handed the phone back to this poor girl, saying, you know who I am, don't you? Tell him you know who I am.
When we started these, I said nobody in the history of show business has ever said the word, do you know who I am? Because nobody actually ever says that. And when stories, they say, and that's why we were not just disallowing any story that has in it, do you know who I am?
No, disallowing any story that has to do with you.
No, I'm allowing the story. But she's the wrong girl to tell it. It was the person at Visa can tell that. You know, they give this to us one day. This is, I don't know if anyone else gets this. They say, are you going to use the card again today? I said, I don't know. You've stopped me in every shop I've been in. I'm now out an hour. I should have been out for 20 minutes. Every shop you go into, they want to speak to you. What's your mother's maiden name? I don't know what my mother's maiden name was. You do. So I was giving all of that. Went into the next shop, did it again. They did it again. They were obviously teasing the poor old host. And then they said, when you go into the next shop, just say the password snow. Snow. That'll stop all this. So I went to the next shop. Gave it over, said, by the way, snow. And I went, okay. We got a nut, get the big butterfly in it. Oh, I remember, I was just perfectly well. But she's telling the story against herself, and it wasn't against herself. If the woman from Visa wants to ring up, and I'll give you more, honey, plenty more where that came from. Although I'm saying it's justified, and I'm on the side, once again, of the celebrity. Lionel Blair was in the right.
We just so happened to be
here. Lionel Blair was in the right. Danny LaRue was in the right. Paul Daniel Kelly. So Savalas totally in the right.
Danny Baker is in the right.
You see, the public had been whining away for years about, he said, you know who I am. I am now forming a celebrity front, but we're saying, we dislike the public, and if you had one net, we would hack it through. That's what they're saying. It's basically how we feel about the public. Good morning. We're here every morning from 6 until 9. And now here we go with a poem that was sent to a Sheffield 15-year-old poem. From Sue. You read this originally, Annie, but forgive me if I take it over here. So it'll be, here we go. This is on the back of the desert story. She wrote this. We're in the desert, and the sun is shining piteously down, like a red hot brazier shining in the sky. It's oh so hot. We're nearly crawling on the ground. If only some pious saints would give me some water. Water. To quench my flaming thirst. Thirst. I'm so thirsty. Thirst. Thirst. I'm so thirsty. When she was 15. And if anyone's got any poetry they wrote, Natalie, you never rang in with yours. And my niece Natalie has some in her poetry she wrote when she was 11. She said, I can't possibly. Well, that's not the spirit.
I assume that's brazier.
Brazier. Did I say brazier?
Red hot brazier.
Could be. What can I tell you?
That's
right. It's an easy mistake to make. Yeah, exactly. A red hot brazier in the sky.
You can see quite better, isn't it?
If you see an old workman up there, I see Lola Brigida. That's all I'm telling you. If you've got any 15-year-old poetry over the weekend at margaret.rutherford@bbc.co.uk. Can't think of what else I've done than that. I'm just thinking, people are surprised me doing that. And then there's seeing Danny LaRue turn around. I think we're doing that in...
There must be a clip show.
Plenty of builders out there, David. I don't know. Oh, the Grand Floridian Hotel in Florida, man. I think they really did. Oh, they had leaf blowers going while I was sitting by the pool, wasn't having that. A really good one that was, isn't it? But, you know, I'm betting without myself. But, you know, we have John Goldfield in that. Oh, yeah, you know, there you go, stocking trade. You don't know that side of me, Andy.
I'm sure it will be revealed.
Oh, you know, sooner or later, we'll get round to that. So, he also sent us a real-life Tasty Brothers, and we can do this now. It is, of course, Johnny Dankworth's Beef Eaters, and towards the end of it, we all know the piece of music, but the Tasty Brothers turn up here. Here they come. It's already good, but you wait for the Tasties to kick in. Here they come. Ladies and gentlemen, only one of the Tasties, here he comes. What an example. Listen to that. Wow, what? I mean, that is the best example of real life taste we've ever seen.
Yeah.
What a tremendous piece of taste. Things animals are capable of eating.
Oh, right, okay.
Given half a chance.
Right.
Given half a chance, you know they'll eat up leather, they'll eat lead. Given half a chance, lead soldier on the floor to an animal is a snack. Yeah.
Well, basically, we got a phone call from someone.
Oh, not this thing about not eating chocolate. We did this in February. You must tell people animals mustn't eat chocolate, or would they? Yeah, mate. We're talking about eating lead paint. The idea was, animals given half a chance, they will eat their own feces.
Exactly.
My friends.
They're saying
give animals chocolate for
them. Go away. Don't worry someone else.
They're saying that if you feed.
I'm not saying.
Dogs, it's poisonous. But I was watching Animal Hospital last night, to my shame, and they were feeding the dogs chocolate.
The thing is, there should be world and the what is world. Yes, I know. If you give animals certain, you know, if you give them goose pate, it's too rich for, etc., etc. However, the phone in my friends who, like, you know, laughed at a joke when they were about nine, is, if you heard it, was things animals given half a chance will eat. And people are ringing up saying, you know, I left a dope cake in the room, came back, the boxer had ate it. That's what happens. Now,
we better get on to them and tell them to warn people not to...
Yeah, right. I cannot be dealing with that, because otherwise they'll be saying, don't leave your front room, sunlight's bad for you. By the way, the milk gives you a heart attack. Don't give animals chocolate. Shut up.
Shut up and go away. Shut up and go away. So that's it. We're not going to deal with that. I'll turn it to John Gaunt.
I just thought I'd, flag it up.
They were
feeding chocolate to dogs on animals.
Because you know why? Because people do. Because people are not geniuses and people are not, and people do. And animals do eat them. And I came on, one of our dogs, we still haven't determined which one, had got up on a chair, got up onto the island in the centre of the kitchen, jumped from the island in the centre of the kitchen to the sink, and then just pulled down the kitchen roll and had eaten the kitchen roll. And all the inks in it and everything else. Yeah.
And then, oh, by the way, you mustn't tell them to eat the chocolate.
What about the kitchen roll? What about the lead soldiers?
Paper products to dogs.
No, you don't. Dogs want... The thing is, they don't know anything about animals. All they know about is worrying other humans. They don't know anything about animals. If you leave a metal soldier covered in mercury in the middle of a room, a dog will eat it. There's a degree of difference between that and feeding them it.
The great thing is you can wave a great big juicy steak in front of it and it will spit it out
and eat the soldier. By the way, it should be cooked to a temperature of and put this thermometer in the middle because they're innocent little things, animals. They're persecuted by humans. Yeah, right. We're fighting back. We're fighting by the way, the lead paint. Leave the lid off it today, folks.
Okay.
When I saw that, don't give them chocolate. Oh, that's right. Oh, God, I feel so guilty about, entertaining people on the radio. Go away. Leave me alone. Go away. Worry Capital Radio. They're thick like you as well. Mark, what have you got for us?
Okay, Dan, it's not me, it's about my brother, but I thought it was a good story.
This is I thought my parents were going to kill me story, yeah.
I thought my parents were going to kill my brother, but they did actually.
Go on.
He was very vain as a teenager, and he was about to go out on a sort of hot date, and his hairdryer broken.
His hairdryer broken? This is a brother of yours.
This is my brother, yeah, he was very vain.
Okay.
So his hairdryer broken, what he did to dry his hair was he turned the heating on full. Then he went into the kitchen and he turned all of the four gas rings on the hob on full and stood in the kitchen.
So he tried to turn the house into a giant hairdryer.
Yeah.
Okay, it's all very good.
It gets better. When his hair had sort of half dried, he left to go out, but he left the cooker on and the heating on full.
As long as his hair was okay, of course everything else flew out the window.
Absolutely.
And he's a little disappointed he didn't dry quite the way he wanted, and he said, and out he went, okay.
So my parents came back, I don't know how many hours later, and thought, the house is a bit hot. Went into the kitchen, and we had polystyrene sort of tiles on the ceiling. They were sort of dripping off the ceiling. All of the kitchen units, the outside, the plastic bits on the outside, was dripping onto the floor. He melted the kitchen.
She thought she'd gone out and she came back and the kitchen had suddenly been redesigned by Dali. Very good. And of course, the roof being hit. Were you there when the explosion happened from the parents?
I wasn't. I was away at the time.
Oh, I see.
But the backlash reverberated to Newcastle.
I was going to say, my echoes of this are never going to be as good as anything like that. A black felt tip pen on a brand new sofa. I've got all of those going on. I may save them because we're going to drip this through the week because I think there's a lot more mileage in it. But anyway, here to Marks and Spencer's, who once sold edible flowers. Yes, they did. And then they wondered why they were going out of business. I bought them. Edible flowers, very bitter. Very bitter. Probably pansies and poppies.
Basically, they were just flowers.
They were flowers, but they sold them to people who like to shop in M&S when there's some cachet to that before Sainsbury's got themselves together.
I used to be partial to a few begonias once in a while.
Have you eaten begonias?
Yeah, busy lizzies and begonias are quite nice.
You serious? Well, because I'm very practical in most things.
Yeah.
But faddish foods, I'm all for.
Yeah.
I will eat anything like that. I'm busy lizzies and begonias like that now.
They have that little sort of bulbous thing right at the base of the petal.
Bulbous busy lizzies and begonias.
Right at the base of the petal.
Now,
once you bite into that, a little burst of acid comes out.
That's what it is. It's now with added acid. That's what they had on the front.
That's what I look for in a vegetable. A little acid
crack. Now with even more acid. You asked for it. Here it is. You drop it on the floor like the alien. It melts through to the flat below. So M&S up, BA down.
Absolutely, yes.
You haven't any money at all in M&S, have you?
I haven't, no. Can you tell?
No, it's not that, Dave. It's just I'm starting to, again, question the wisdom of our financial expert who has money in a company that's gone through the floor but has none in all in one that's actually doing quite well these days. And he's passing on the savings to us, the consumers. Well, thank you very much indeed, and thank you very much for resisting the option of when I said that is the second most extraordinary thing I've ever heard of saying the second most. Should we do that now? He's gone. What a shame.
The second most.
Oh, he's always back again. The second most. You know the most extraordinary thing I ever heard is, David? The country Brazil is named after the Brazil nut, not the other way round. Ola, that'd be a perfect time to get us out of here. ELO's gone. Chris Evans, who's listening right now in Los Angeles. Chris, Barry Impinner took your ELO. The only group Chris knows. I swear to God, a man who owned a radio station, when you sit with Chris and start talking about rock music, and he's saying things like Chuck Berry and the band, Bob Dylan, and he sits with his hands in his lap, and he's enjoying the conversation and making all the right noises, and then he will wait for just a short opening in it and go, did anybody... anybody ever see ELO? And next day you'll be talking about, I don't know, whether the Sex Pistols revolutionized music or killed it, and what's happening with the whole Jimmy Eat World versus techno argument, and then he'll go, I'll tell you a good record, that Mr. Blue Sky. Anybody get this? He's only got one subject. Man, does he enjoy them. The ELO. I'm not kidding. ELO, is that it for Chris? That's as far as it goes. And quite rightly, I think.
Because you played this first.
Anyway, it's gone, Chris. I should have given you that. I did this a long time ago, but I've just seen this thing. In Antarctica, sunsets can be green. In Antarctica, sunsets can be green.
Yeah, I saw this in the paper yesterday.
I've just written it in this book. Really?
Oh, really?
Really?
Yeah. It's the sort of reverse of the aurora borealis, you know, the northern lights.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like the southern lights. And it happens.
Aurora Australis.
Thank you very much indeed.
And it happens, I don't know, once
wasn't Jeff coming down to get my school, yeah.
Wow.
And they had a photograph of it. I think it was in the Independent.
The phone in on the back of that, which we haven't done for a long, long time. We'll do this tomorrow, because today the teeth thing and elsewhere we were pretty full up. But tomorrow is you've seen things in a different colour than they should be. Because I'm a sucker for that. When you go in and in Sainsbury's at the moment, they're selling these orange and green tomatoes. They're fantastic, very nutty, very good. But the first thing that attracted me to them is because they were a different colour. They're bright orange. And you think, ooh, bright orange tomatoes. Oh, I'll buy those. Just because and the yellow tomatoes you can get. And I think that in itself should be...
Yeah, green ketchup.
Yes, green ketchup. Yeah. I bought that, yes. It's all
you
right.
Bought that?
Yeah, of course. Why not? Why not? We're on... And I often say, Andy, we only get 60 summers on this planet actively. If you're going to see green ketchup, what are you going to do? Wonder about it? Buy it. It tastes exactly the same.
You thought they'd have had natural coloured carrots out by now as well.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, with all that pump full of that stuff. Well,
instead of the dyed orange ones.
Are you teasing an old host?
No, did we assume this is something we talked about?
Yeah, the Dutch kind of changed the colour.
Orange.
Yeah, they changed the colour.
No, oranges were never, carrots were never originally orange, it was the Dutch who made them orange to affect their
natural
colour.
See, I don't know whether you get together in the 5:15 a.m. pre-show cocktails, I don't know if you get together before I'm going to say,
do the carrot one.
Really?
No, I hate it, it was on the news.
Yeah, it was on the news, it's been all in the news. Carrots were originally purple and now they're orange. But, I mean, they've been orange for a couple hundred years
I
now.
I don't particularly like purple carrots, but I'd buy a sack full of those, wouldn't you?
Just think, you know, Gerry Adams has probably eaten one of those carrots as well. Would that even know?
Knowing exactly what the deal was with it. Yeah. Political... Oh, well, I didn't know that. Anyway, tomorrow we're doing things that are... you've seen things that were a surprising colour, like a green sunset.
I've got a guest on the phone.
Have you?
Yeah, we did. Teresa Wilde.
Oh, right. Okay,
yeah.
Sure.
Good morning, Teresa.
Oh, good. I didn't realize you had somebody.
Teresa.
Hello.
Hello, Teresa. Now, I know I've been a bit skeptical about this whole flea business, but you're going to put me right, aren't you? Teresa's from the Lord Walter Rothschild Zoological Museum in Tring.
Oh, I can't tell you how happy I am, you see.
Yeah.
When she said, just quickly, Teresa, when you said there, Amy, we've got Teresa Wilde on the phone, because usually you deal in the rarefied world of arts and entertainments and not sort of films and telly, I thought, oh, right, yeah, Teresa, well, she's very good. I thought, Teresa Wilde. But now I realise the full majesty. Well, Teresa, please, it's all yours, Amy, skeptic.
So, Teresa, I hear you actually do have two fleas dressed as Mexican peasants. Is that
true? Certainly we do, yes. We're a branch of Naturalist Museum in Tring, and we have two from the turn of the century collected by Lord Rothschild's brother, and they're on display at our museum in Tring.
And they're underneath a big magnifying glass, aren't they?
Absolutely, yeah.
I knew I saw this because the big centre, if you will, the kind of Rockefeller centre of fleas dressed up as famous people or traditional costume, is in Spain. Am I right, Teresa? There is one there.
There is one there, yes, as far as I know. Yeah, I think so, yeah.
I can hear your lip curling. You're aware of its work.
Yes, I am, yeah.
How did you come by these fleas?
Well, the museum itself is absolutely amazing. It's got 4,000 animals collected by the second Lord Rothschild, an incredibly eccentric collector, end of last century.
Yeah.
And he sent people out, he bought them, he collected them from all over the world, different animals, and he wanted the most bizarre, the biggest, everything. And these fleas.
Yeah.
And what he's got there, they were made as a tradition in Mexico as sort of tourist things by women in their houses. And they usually use cat fleas or human fleas, and they dress them up as different things. Naturist Museum has some in the collections as well. We've got some dressed as bride and groom as well. We had out a few months ago.
A little tiny veil.
Yes.
Has she got a little tiny bouquet?
Yes, she has.
Top of the shop.
Is he wearing a top hat?
Of course he's wearing a top hat.
Yes.
Yes. And these are made just by peasants?
Yes, they were made by mostly Mexican women working from home as a way of earning extra money.
I see. Every time I raise this subject, people think, oh, you know, slight of fancy here. And we always have to someone ring in and say, the place is in Tring. Now, how comes you aren't up there with Madame Tussauds and everything else? Because this, if they open the new Star Wars film this side of the road, and on the other side of the road there's a neon sign saying, come in, see fleas dressed as famous people, which way are you going to turn? Left or I know where I'm going.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Well, we need lots of literature on this.
who first had the idea to dress fleas?
Mexican peasants.
Well, it goes back a couple of hundred years. Before 19th century, so presumably they did. I mean, we've got an awful lot of detail about that.
They're real fleas, and they sit there. They haven't even got a jeweller's eyepiece, and they have to work with these things, putting on a little bouquet, and then probably there wasn't museums around. They just did it to amuse themselves, and why not? And believe me, when I hear John Gaunt show about the graffiti art, kids got nothing to do, you know, and all of this. No. They should be dressing up fleas as famous people, and then now we haven't got the ship industry anymore, we haven't got the cars, we haven't got the mines, we could do that, because Mexico plainly can't be bothered anymore. Where exactly is your museum?
It's in Tring, which is very close to Aylesbury, off the A41. But if people like to see them on our website, we're on the Natural History Museum's website, under galleries under Tring. They'll be able to see the two dressed as Mexican... Mexican peasants.
In Spain they have Henry VIII and his six wives, but of course, you know, they've probably got the bigger budget and the government's probably all behind it, as opposed to here. Now, it's just on 7:15, so we've got to wind this up, Teresa, and thank you very much, Amy, for bringing this to my attention. Teresa, if there was something else to rival this as an attraction, I know you're going to be fair, they're all your children, you don't want to name one over the other, but if people who are going to come and see the fleas dressed as famous Mexican peasants may also be interested in what other attraction do you feel?
Within the museum?
Yeah, with another attraction that is equally as bizarre.
An 8-foot cassowary. An 8-foot rear, giant rear.
The biggest rear in London. And there is some contemplation on that in the London area. Certainly entering. Thank you very much, Teresa Walton. Anyway, Mark, there's a great food ordering scene in what?
In the Blues Brothers, then.
Okay, give us the details of it in your memory.
Well, there's two, actually. There's one where he orders... four chickens and a Diet Coke.
Yes, four chickens and a Diet Coke. Very good.
Yeah. Excellent.
Yeah.
The one that really amuses me is when the LAPD finally catch up with the boys at the concert, and John Candy decides that he fancies an orange whip.
An orange whip?
Yes. And he says to the other members, I fancy an orange whip. Orange whip? Orange whip? Orange whip?
you've seen a lot of mileage in great food ordering scenes. The five easy pieces, hats off. Yes, you don't need any more. Five easy. But orange whip. Who knew that was used so much? In Harry Met Sally here, we've been emailed to us. Harry Met Sally, of course, she says, and we've got the actual quote here. Harry, I'll have a number three, says Harry. And Sally says, I'd like the chef salad, please, with the oil and the vinegar on the side and the apple pie a la mode. And the chef goes, chef, and apple pie, the waitress says, apple pie a la mode. And then Sally says, but I'd like the pie heated, and I don't want ice cream on top. I want it on the side, and I'd like strawberry instead of vanilla, only if you have it. If not, then no ice cream, just whipped cream. But only if that's real and not out of a can. If not that, then nothing. And the waitress says, what, not even the pie? Oh, no, the pie, but don't heat it. And that's
that's like my grandmother ordering in a restaurant.
Really, she's particularly picky.
Yes, very picky. But you can get away with that in America.
No, you can. They're staggered when you just say, you know, you get kind of polite about it. At first, it's very intimidating, you know, when the British first started going to America regularly. You just say that, you know, how do you want the eggs? And we'll
say, yeah, I remember the first time I got asked.
First time that ever happened. You think,
do I have a choice?
Yeah. And they look at you and say, oh, geez, yes, of course.
What kind of toast do you want? White, brown, rye, sourdough?
Yeah.
But now, if they do ask you, how do you want your eggs? You say, boiled, please. And they go,
Boiled? Yeah. It's tough to get a boiled egg anywhere in the world. In Italy, it's virtually impossible. And when they do it, they bring up this goo that's like been shown a photograph of some heat and taken away again.
I got brought two boiled eggs in a bowl. I said, well, I can have them in a cup.
In a bowl?
You want them in a cup? I said, yeah, in an egg cup.
Egg. I know you. Anyway, let's go to Doug in Croydon. Doug, good morning,
Doug. Hello, Danny.
Good morning, Doug. Sorry to have lost you before you fell off the air. What have you got for us, Doug?
I've got a second food ordering scene from Midnight Run.
Oh, right, because as we know in Midnight Run, he tries to get all surf and turf action going, and he does
that thing with absolutely. Yeah, it's later on in the film when he's in the cafe and they got no money, and he says he wants chorizo and eggs.
And is this when he steals the money back? No,
yeah, that's right, and he steals the money, and he's trying to order chorizo and eggs, and she says, oh, you know, that's $5 or something, and he says, how much have we got? He says, oh, we've got $1.35. He says, what can I get for $1.35?
And
the waitress says, well, you can have coffee or tea, and he says, how much is tea? No, how much is coffee? And she says, that's 75 cents. He says, how much is tea? That's 75 cents. I'll have tea.
Yes. See, the thing is, you've got to know Charles Grodin's delivery, because, you know, as Doug toughed it out, you think, well, where's the delivery? Where's the punch in this? And exactly how it is in the film. The whole film was held up for a pure moment of Charles Grodin. I got $1.35. What can I get for that? Well, you can get coffee or tea. And how much is coffee? 75 cents. And how much is tea? 75 cents. I'll have tea. You paid to watch this? But Charles Grodin, the absolute number one. Thank you very much indeed for that. We're looking for great food ordering scenes.
Who's the Blues Brothers? Yeah, four chickens and a Diet Coke, and dry toast, isn't it?
I don't know. Do you know, I was winging that, because I've only ever seen the Blues Brothers.
No, I think it was...
to a soul food restaurant, and Elwood only ever eats dry toast.
Yeah, well, I've only ever seen that one.
About four chickens.
Yeah.
And then they go to the kitchen at the back, and the guy goes, four chickens, and a Diet Coke.
Hang on.
Jake. It's a dry toast, Elwood. And that's when he...
I know we're getting bogged down here in food ordering things, but as we're talking about Charles Grodin, in The Heartbreak Kid, which is one of the great films, The Heartbreak Kid, I presume people know The Heartbreak Kid, and she orders an egg salad sandwich in there, and it gathers around the corners of her mouth. It's the first morning after their wedding, the two losers who fell in love with each other, and he realises he's got to get out of the marriage because she has egg salad on the side of her mouth. Now, The Heartbreak Kid is full of good food ordering scenes. And the second thing he realizes he's going to hate this woman is because she says, do you want a piece of... She's got like a Mars bar. Do you want a piece of... No, honey, I don't want a piece. And he goes, have a piece. No, I don't want a piece of Mars. And she puts it right to the edge of his mouth. He goes, come on, have a piece. And he's thinking, I'm going to have to kill this person. And this is what she's got. You better have some now, because in a minute it's going to be in my tummy. And he thinks, I'm just married you. Oh, my God. Anyway, back to yesterday. So, got quite a few people at the moment coming around looking at the garden saying this could happen with it and that could happen with it. It's all very exciting. But yesterday, can I just bring you... So, I'm waiting for this fella to come, and then there's... Oh, I'll get that. And I open the door and... Oh, no, stop it. Stop banging on the door. Hang on. We can do this. Oh, no, don't come. No, nobody give me any help. That's the main thing. Hang on. Here we go. Hold on. No, that's not it. That's why. Hold on. No, please. Hold that thought. Oh, here we go. Hold that thought. It'll be worth it. Here we go. Right, so yesterday, we're indoors. I'm Nick Cass. That's not Cass the producer. Any complaints, go to Cass the producer. So I'm indoors yesterday, Cass. And what time's the next bus going to come around? About 2:30, because the last one was good. I think we should cancel the others. We should go with the others. No, let's see this other fella. So, oh, I'll get that. So open the door and... come through here. The garden, it's at the back of the house. What am I talking about? I'm not concentrating because I look above his eyebrows and... Can, and is there a moral, is there a wider cosmic question of this? Can you trust a gardener who has a wig?
Well, is he a celebrity gardener?
No, he can't grow anything. He can't even garden above his own eyebrows. So what's going on there? And the thing was that I thought, Wendy's going to see him in a minute. So we went down the stairs which lead out to the garden. I said, Wendy, the fella's here. And she went, oh, just come through here. It's just, oh, my God. Yeah. And I thought, if he listened to the show this morning, he obviously hadn't listened to the show this morning because he would never have turned up. Yeah, and he's talking about planting things and what can grow, and this will be good because this can lie fallow over here, and you know, you might. And I think at the one, the word compost heap turned up, and I nearly fainted. Oh. It turned up, and yeah.
Like we were saying yesterday, though, men who are involved in the world of showbiz tend to have these implants, but he's just your ordinary.
Well, it made me come up with a great phrase when he left, because I said, well, what's the cosmic question here? Can you trust a gardener who wears a wig? Is there some connection? No, you can't. It's like having an unmarried marriage counsellor. I don't know why that works, but I think that's perfect. Listen up, everyone. Jeffrey was here. Well, how long ago, Graham, was it? Oh, was it? He was on the Saturday. He was on Mel and Sue, wasn't he? He was on Mel and Sue. And he was sitting outside, and I don't know how old Jeffrey is, but the one thing, and this is not a wig, the one thing is, are we aware of the phrase, a gin blossom?
Yes.
I walked out, and the hooter had cost him a few quid, and he said, Annie, how are you? And I looked at him, and oh, whoa, there's only one feature there, blazing. Wow, that was something going on. Ever should play that again? I'm sure. He's got a gin blossom. His old hooter has cost him a few quid. You'd have to, you know, really,
really?
A little X factor on the hooter, please, Jeffrey, before you go on. I think, yeah. So we don't know if that was caused by some other ailment, or whether during the down years, you know, him and Johnny used to roll home every night. We don't know. This will all be revealed in the show, of course. But you're ringing in because you can use the phrase, I thought my parents were going to kill me. What have you got?
Right, okay. We're on holiday in Wales with my best friend, Lee.
Mm-hmm.
We're a little bit bored one afternoon. We travelled over the nearest fields and some friends of my parents.
Yeah.
We're chatting with them. We're about 15 at the time. Lee was fairly bored. He just wasn't concentrating on the conversation. And it was the father going on with great pride over this very small oak tree.
Yeah.
About 2 inches high, and he was going on about it's going to be family heirloom, grow the woods, you know, and all that sort of business.
Mm-hmm.
Lee then woke up. He realized that he had a lot of sheep excrement actually on his feet, leant down, picked up the entire small oak tree and wiped his feet with it in front of my father's best friend.
Oh.
My father's best friend is very middle class, so obviously just didn't want to mention it. Just stifled it completely.
And obviously the tree didn't survive such a...
Unfortunately not, no.
How?
No.
And was there an upshot? Of course, with the petition for a settlement, the parents do actually kill the children who do it. But it is a genuine feeling while it lasts, isn't it?
Yeah, there was a stifled rage, but the middle classness sort of kicked in.
Oh,
I mentioned it obviously to Lee afterwards, and he blushed slightly.
Oh, I mean, he could have killed it in many, many ways, but the idea is just to get the...
It was sacrificed to clean his shoes in front of the person who had been going on about the heirloom-like qualities.
See, if that story isn't worth a pound, I'd like to know what is. Send Tim a pound. That's got a bit of an lexicon of voice going on there, which is always good. Anyone who's read the Joe Alton Diaries, and reread the Joe Alton Diaries, or left them on a train with a load of yobbos once, very quickly, Jason.
Yeah.
I was on a train out of Blackheath when they used to run out of Blackheath, not like now. I was on a train and I was researching my Times column. There it is. I've hit the thing. And I was reading this magazine, Flex, which is the bodybuilders magazine. And there was about four kids got in at Lewisham. They bugger up. Oh, look. He's reading the queer magazine. Right now, I could hear him. And I thought, oh, they're going to have a confrontation here. I said, no, let's... And I put it down and I said, oh, no, what I'm doing is... And there were huge photos of crotches and biceps. And I left it on the train when I got off. I said, no, have a look at that. I thought all that entirely. What I forgot about is I was reading the Joe Alton Diaries. And that was my real book I had. That was the side of me. When I got out of Charing Cross or Waterloo, see you, boys. They pulled away and went over to and opened the Joe Alton Diaries, which I had with me. Can you imagine what that does to young kids? I apologise, as you probably don't know. In the Joe Alton Diaries, anyway, on his mum's, the day of his mum's funeral, he arrived back from Leicester to Luke was in progress, turned up at the theatre, and while they were blocking it before the night's performance, doing a little re-rehearsing, he threw his dead mother's teeth onto the stage and freaked everyone out. They said, how did the funeral go, Joe? And he said, I'll show you, and just threw the teeth onto the stage. Now, I don't know where that leaves us. Jason, thank you very much. Victor Spinetti, you know the jumper?
He wears
during those scenes because he's directing the show.
That's right, he was in that scene, yeah.
Do you know where that jumper is now?
No.
In the Smithsonian Institute in the United States, sir. In its own cabinet, sir.
It's really looking.
By the bonded
jacket.
No, sir. And I'll talk to you, and I'm saying to him, I'll pump people for Beatles information, as I'm doing with you.
Yeah.
And he said, you know what? He said, I had a request. Do you have anything from it? And I said, I've still got the big mohair jumper I wore, and it's in the Smithsonian.
Oh, it's that one.
That is something. Of course, we gaggle and gossip, and I'm sure we will. Sorry. But of course, you're here for a reason, friends that we are. And I'm a friend of Sammy Davis here, by the way. Once dance with
him. I'm sitting opposite the desk of a friend of
his. Yes,
Matt is close enough for me.
So, what, you're on tour at the moment, yeah?
Yeah, I'm in a play with George Shaw, and we're doing a play called Who Killed Agatha Christie?
Yeah.
And it's a murder mystery. I'm in Eastbourne, but I'm in my room. They've given me this beautiful room. Facing the sea, sun is shining, it is just beautiful.
And why is there a thing here saying the Golden Jubilee Garden flashing away?
Ah, well, the Golden Jubilee Garden is, I am vice president of a thing called Stage for Age, which is the celebrity arm of Help the Aged. And we have our own Golden Garden.
Okay.
We're even having, and they told me this yesterday, a Queen Elizabeth I look-alike.
Oh, yeah,
now, you know she had red hair.
Well,
not Chris Evans, is it?
I believe Chris was a good story. No, he was Elizabeth I, wasn't he?
Yeah,
he was Elizabeth I. And how has that worked then?
Chris Quinton, did you say?
No, Quinton Chris.
Quinton Chris,
which is almost an anagram of Chris Quinton. So how does this work then? They helped the age of Golden Jubilee Garden? What is in aid of?
It's in aid of age. It's for help the aged.
Yeah. Okay.
And
how does it work? How does that get help the aged?
Well,
what is it? Is it a garden that they can visit?
It's a garden that is created for us. Like everybody, all the gardeners and everything,
okay,
do it for themselves to promote their own garden.
I've got you.
Products.
I've got you now.
A gardener comes in and does it for us to celebrate for help the aged. And all we've got a load of celebs with us in Help the Aged. June Whitfield will be there, and Robert Powell will be there, Diana Moran will be there.
When is it?
Is it on Monday?
On Monday.
Yes. Yeah. And unfortunately, I can't be there. You know where I'm going to be? I'm going to be in Crewe.
Work. That's the deal. I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? Of course. That's why you couldn't attend Sammy's wedding, after all. So, so the June is going to have to
wait. I think I made it for mitzvah, but I'm not sure.
just before we finish, we've been this morning talking about late flowering autograph hunters, people who don't collect autographs, but after, they may have done as a teenager, but it takes 25 years until they come across somebody of some stature. They think, I'm going to have to ask for an autograph. They're middle-aged autograph hunters. But yourself, is there somebody who, have you ever asked for an autograph?
Once.
Go on.
I went to see a play called The Skin of Our Teeth.
Uh-huh.
And in it was Vivian Leigh.
Oh, well, yeah.
And it's the only time I stood at the stage door and waited for somebody to come out. And she came out with that smile, and she sighed. I couldn't say anything. I just held up my book.
And did she do it?
And it was gone with her, of course.
Of course, in the grand old star. Although it would have worked, it'd have been an equally good story, she said, and Vivian spat in my mouth. What a star, what a star.
No star, no.
Even better, Vivian had come out and said, so you're Lionel Blair.
We've got to wrap up because we have to move on now.
It's been great talking
to you. Well, come in because
I'm going to be in Richmond soon with the play. Oh,
there you are.
When I'm in Richmond, I'll get in touch and can I come on?
You bet you can come. By the way, listen to this. We're talking about the Golden Age.
I'll pack down from your desk.
And listen to this.
Hey, there's an
offer. Lionel, listen to this. We're talking about a generation lost to razzmatazz. And just before we go into the travel, just for you two, because this is how it's going to be today, weather-wise, and every other day.
All the barnyard is in a regular check.
You can have your Smith. You can have your Slipknot. You can even have your Beatles and your Rolling Stones. But, ladies and gentlemen, a generation lost to razzmatazz, but not to Lionel Blair. Thank you very much indeed.
God bless you.
See you soon, my friend. Ladies and gentlemen, on the phone from the hotel where he sprawled across silken cushions. The top of the show, the last remaining bastion of British showbiz, the
morning, Lionel.
My favourite song.
What a rendition. No, what a rendition.
Ah,
and
great.
You see, I thought you were in this morning, Lionel, and I was so... I'd
love to have been, Danny. I'm so sorry.
Well, you know, and I brought in so many bits because I thought...
Did you bring your chap shoes?
I couldn't find them anywhere last night. I really couldn't. I think my wife has been borrowing them.
Yes.
And here's the thing. I brought about 6 or 7 pieces because I thought we were going to have a conversation. I'm going to put on something like that and you won't be able to stop.
Oh, well, I wouldn't.
Thinking of the steps there. I mean, as you were hearing that then, I bet you were thinking, yeah, okay, 2, 3, over there, do this. Then that to me is not just a kick line, but for a fellow like yourself, irresistible.
It was a wonderful... Do you know, I saw that show on Broadway with Ethel Merman.
Did you? Not sitting beside you, she was in it, right?
No, yeah. She was in it.
Yeah, she was in it, of course she was.
Actually, who was sitting across the aisle?
Bette Midler had a go at that, but she's never going to be Merman, is she?
No, she
isn't.
It was just... I sat there absolutely mesmerised. She was wonderful.
Yeah, this is a tremendous... See, this is the thing. When I'm saying there, and people think I've got it in quotation marks, and I simply have not, as anyone who knows any of my shows knows, I do believe we are now a generation lost to razzmatazz.
Oh, truthfully.
And that kind of... I mean, yeah, certainly there's big shows to be seen, but not... It's not the currency anymore. There are always revivals, but we've lost the talent of doing that. Now, you were friends with Sammy Davis, am I right?
Of course, my best friend.
Well, see, and you said that not as a
I'm not
speech.
Bragging that. He was my best friend.
When did you meet him?
I met him, I was going to do a show called Sammy Meets the British.
Yeah.
And
When is this? When are we talking about?
1960.
Okay. So,
and I tell you, it's funny, I was staying. Yeah. I'm going to name drop now, Danny.
Oh, please. No, please do, because it's legitimate. Oh, no, yeah. That's not it.
I was staying with Roger Moore and... Uh-huh. A second wife, Dorothy Scott.
It was with Dot at the time.
In Hollywood.
You see, this for me, just before you carry on with it, I was a huge fan of Tony Newley, see, really genuine.
Another thing.
And when he would sit there and say, and once I was performing in Vegas and the mob bought me this chocolate brown Cadillac. Now, I don't drive, so I gave it to Kim Novak. And this is not name dropping. This actually happened. You know, people talk to me about Johnny Rotten and the Clash and stuff. No, these are real. Anyway, carry on.
I was thinking, and suddenly a cable arrived, and I said, I'm going to go back to London.
Yeah.
And she said, they've asked me to do the Sammy Davis show. He's doing his first television show.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say, I couldn't believe it.
Was it May Britt at the time?
Well, he did before he married May. And
You didn't go to the wedding, did you?
No, because that was in America and I was working in England. And I went back to London and he was just going to open at the Figaro in London.
Mm-hmm.
And I met him. And Al Burnett said, who was owned the club.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, Sammy, I'd like to introduce you to Lionel Blair, who's going to be doing it. He went, so you're Lionel Blair.
Did he? Oh,
he said, Shirley Jones and Jack Cassidy said...
Well, it seems a little dream. Name drops keep falling on my head.
And I said, well, I've done some television shows with them in England, you see.
To be able to say that. And of course, now, there's, you know, for the rock and rollers out there, if you can, arthritic though they may be, how long were you working on Hard Day's Night? Was that a 1 day's work or 2 days' work?
It was 2 days.
2 days. And what are your memories of being in A Hard Day's Night?
Well, I remember Paul sitting at a piano, fiddling between takes.
Yeah.
He said, I've got this number I'm trying to work out. And he was sort of creating Yesterday.
Yeah, I've read that about you. I've read that at the front before. And it would have been, it's actually carbon dated, that would have happened. A lot of people saying, oh, come on, apocryphal.
But no, course, it happens.
No, of course, because you're in A Hard Day's Night. That's why we know it happened.
Some people's lungs have a fringe, and it looks every bit like a fringe on your nan's sofa.
All right.
Along the bottom.
How do you know?
It's not given to everyone, because I saw a program once, and that's why, and when they get out of breath, the fringe can whistle. As it blows in the inner wind, I suspect. I don't know how. But they said it does betray, you can always tell when lung fringe is a possibility, because the wheeziness of, and the fringe itself. You have this kind of maelstrom going on in your chest. So I may be the lung fringe, but we're not doing that anyway. We are doing the great rock and roll giveaway. I appreciate the people who are struggling through and getting through with films that are the opposite of each other and cancel each other out. Bambi and the Deer Hunter, of course Bambi. Rain Man, the Sunshine Boys. Happiness and Misery, Perfect Storm, Dead Calm. Men in Black, the man in the white suit is the opposite of that. It's got Lady in Red here, but it's not. Sleeper, Waking Life. Electric Blue, Clockwork Orange. Free Willy and Juno and the Paycock. Oh, Paycock Free Willy, I suppose so. Oh. Now, come on, easy, easy.
Oh.
I suppose.
No, 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 no. It's too early for that.
Hang on, we've just been talking about lung fringes. but anyway, so 0207 224 2000.
I hate this so much that, in fact, if Linda likes it, I think we're finished. And we came out of the... To tell you the story, it's true. And we came out of the screening in silence, and there was this moment. We came out, we walked down the corridor and a little bit, and there's something, and I went, well? And she went... hateful. I'm like,
yeah, 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 that's my gal, you said. Here we're going to go to a Low in Shadwell, as in Arthur. Thank you very much. Low in Shadwell with a very good Mr. Men call. Now, it has to be. The last one we took gave us Mr. Men in Hebrew. So, Low, what have you got for us, my friend?
I can do Mr. Men for you in Afrikaans.
Do what?
In African Afrikaans.
Oh, now, hang on.
Mr. Bach.
Well, you can do Mr. Men in Afrikaans. Now, have you got a book there that can help you with it, or are you going to ad lib it?
Yes. You know, I've got Mr. Forgetful with me.
Okay, Mr. Forgetful. Now, let me find an appropriate piece of Afrikaans music. Let me. I have most with me. Yes, here we go. Happened to have it, so I had no prior warning of this, but here we go.
Okay.
I have to pull this out of the air, a piece of classic Afrikaans music, above which a radio first. And the same show will be brought to you both French, which is not a stretch, and Hebrew, Mr. Men. Now we have Mr. Men in Afrikaans. With Barbara Streisand right in the back. Off you go, my friend.
Okay, meneer Vergeetvol, dit is een van die wonderlike someroggende geweest wat almal geniet.
Slow down, it's a beautiful thing, you don't have to rush it. Off you go, go on.
Okay, dit is een van die wonderlike someroggende geweest wat almal geniet. En vergeet my nie, huis was die eienaar vas aan die slaap geweest. Meneer Vergeetvol.
A radio first. Low there, and Low, of course, Low, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed that. It was Mr. Forgetful, did he say that?
Or Mr. Forgetful.
It was Mr. Forgetful. In Afrikaans, only here. You see, I know Radio 5's got its strengths. I know you've outgrown us little Tom shows now. You know, a little dog and monkey show we do here every morning. But you're not going to get that on Radio 5. Barbara Streisand backing us now, you've never heard of, saying Mr. Men books in Afrikaans.
Neither will I ever discover that if you put a whole bunch of flies in a... How do you attach the flies to the... Just tell me.
Candle wax.
You get the two lolly stick to stick. I'm going to stress that I'm not going to do this, but I just want to know for science.
Dip candle wax across the... What was the flying machine.
Stick the flies on them while they're asleep. Their legs... The candle
is
wax.
Is this actually set. True?
No, I just want to let you know what's happening today on BBC.
It's not quite right. The pair of them over there are drawing diagrams now. I can't believe it.
Well, of course, after...
80 years old between you. Come on.
Eddie Nestor is up after us. And today's his last day because Gonti's back on Monday.
That's the plan.
I know.
Yeah. Let's do the joke once more. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
John.
John who?
That's show business. He's been 3 weeks away. He's been away 3 weeks, and that's how it's working out. Everything's very, very good.
Well, Eddie's on till noon, at which point Jackie Kloon takes over. She's in for Robert Elms until 3 o'clock, and she'll be talking about loads of different events happening at the Serpentine Gallery Pavilion, one being the party on Wednesday that we gave the tickets away for, and also they're showing Orlando tonight in the pavilion, an open-air screening of Orlando, which is a lovely way to spend a Friday evening.
Orlando's got Jimmy Somerville on the end of a train.
Yeah, playing an angel, at the very end. She'll also have a music aficionado, Billy Reeves, in asking the question, what's all the fuss about, the Smiths?
Oh, really?
So I'll be tuning in. I'll be texting.
Lucky she does. Amy's the number one.
Well, I'm going to have to relate, and I'm going to go see both.
Are you?
Because Bowles and Tim used to be in the podcast together. Now Bowles has played for
Charles Dickens in his early work.
And Vanessa is on between 3 and 5 with her usual rantings and ravings, and I really love the show because she's a rambunctious lady.
Turning around them afternoons. Now, well, Mark, it's been a tremendous thing. It's a great reunion, and it's every bit as magnificent as I remember your casting your eye over the modern movies. However, speaking of that and the ultra-modern movies, what is in production now we should look forward to? Is there anything in this summer of trash that you actually think, hang on, hang in there for this one, this will be the next good one?
As far as the summer is concerned, I have to say it's a bit of a stinker. I mean, there's all the really good stuff.
By Christmas, is there something that is going to...
Well, by Christmas, yeah, of course, because we're going to get the third Lord of the Rings. And,
oh, I see. Okay.
And I have to say everything now is leading up to that, because I love both Lord of the Rings movies, and it's going to be... I mean, here's Peter Jackson, he's the man... Can I just say, incidentally, back on Morning Edition, when he made his first film, Bad Taste, I said, this is a man to watch, and I was right.
I know, true enough, mind you, we broke 60 decent. around here.
No.
Yes, we do. Good morning, everyone. Have a tremendous weekend. The sun is going to shine. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you, Mark.
My pleasure. Thank you, Mark. My first wife from the week. You're back in
I'll be back tomorrow morning between 6 to 9 with Bill Overton.
In the meantime, BBC London 94.9. Stay with us for Eddie Nestor. This has been The Breakfast Show with Mark Cohen.
Friend of Moby Dick, man.
No, Moby Dick was all right. There's a lot of effort that Martin Kemp with us this morning. The thing was a show that you could Spandau Ballet. No, it's called 20th Century Box about Spandau Ballet. That's right. The name was already taken when we went for it. And I never get it. Was the toughest thing, Martin's reminiscence in a minute, because it was about the third telly program I'd ever done. I was boss-eyed and sitting in the studio like the kid at The Simpsons. And I had to say, we're looking at a group who now people feel will be ushering in a whole new era in rock music, right? And that's what I'd say, ushering in a whole new era in rock music. Do you think I could say that? I said, can't I just say, you know, a breaking barriers? And No, you've got to say Gentry Port Richard. No, you've got to say this. I wrote that, you've got to say, are ushering in a whole new era in rock music? I said, oh, no. And then I did about 30 takes and people thought, you know, the kids are going to be around 5 minutes. And right, they were.
You're very good on the show. Very good on
that
show.
They did the following week. I had to say what life is like at the wrong end of the greyhound gravy train. These things are scarred
these words come along to haunt us.
Looking at the little black and white film, and there you were humping your own gear down, despite the sheen the group had, the kilts, what it came to be, and all of that. You were just a bunch of lads humping your gear from gig to gig.
Working class guys, you know. And, I mean, that show was huge for us, the 20th Century Box, because we were over in Saint-Tropez at the time, and in a small club called the Papagaya for 2 weeks, and which we thought, you know, we had a lot of heat on us at that particular time, so we thought we'd go away so we can actually practice playing with an audience. And while we were there, your show came out, 20th Century Box, and it just sent us through the roof. You know, every record company in Britain wanted to sign us for good figures.
Did you come out of Spandau with much money? I mean, I know that becomes a contentious thing, but everyone tends to think, and every kid going into a band now thinks, yes, when you sign those contracts, you get all that money. It doesn't work like that in a pop group, does it?
Spandau was incredibly successful. It lasted for 10 years.
But do you still own? I mean, I know there's all of that argument, you know, when the dust has settled and all that. I mean, technically, did you ever go nuts and sell away your stuff as a group, like Brian Wilson did?
We were always very sensible.
That's cool.
Yeah, so we come out with it enough.
You know, it's entered into common parlance as well, doing a Spandau Ballet.
Go on.
Which is getting a cab to the gig and a cab back.
Yeah.
You know,
but I only got from the corner of the street. From the corner of the street, that's all it was.
Yeah.
But
get the limo to drop you off around the corner.
You go and so and so tonight. Yeah, I'm doing a Spandau.
Is that what it was, Mike? Did you all sit down? Because obviously it was just after Funk Rock. Did you all sit down and say, let's take this to the other end? I mean, all right, there had been precedent for it, of course, Bowie and Roxy Music and stuff. But it was literally coming in from the North Pole at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was plan. It was just. It was the way it was happening in the club.
But you certainly weren't Joy Division. You didn't want to go down that. That's clear, wasn't it?
But I was going myself and my brother, we were going to this club called The Blitz and Billy's. And that's the scene that was happening in those clubs. So all Spandau Ballet was doing was, it was no big, great idea. It was just, we were representing the kids that were in there.
So even then, did you think, well, I'm an actor and I'm going to go back to doing that? Seriously, did you think that? Or was the pop star? Was it like Bowie an act being a pop star?
Yeah, no, it was a bit of everything, to be honest. I mean, if you go to drama school when you're 7 years old and it becomes part of your blood, it becomes part of your personality. So whatever you do, you can use those tools that you've been given, you know, and I think I was using mine inside the band, to be honest, because I was never a great musician. Being a musician was my brother's job, and you know, I was just part of this band, and I suppose my kind of corner of the band was the way it looked. Yeah. And I would say, this is what we should wear, this is what we should do,
mistakes, along the way, did you say there were mistakes along the way in that particular department?
Yeah, you could say that, there were a few.
Was that the video at the London Dungeons, was that Muscle Bound you did?
No, that was the very first one, that was to cut a long story short, which I was very proud of that. Well, that's heart and
thing is, it's embedded since that first show, but that is a groove, that... You can use that over and over, and I'm sure surprised somebody hasn't made another huge show.
Well, you know, if a band goes on for 10, 11 years, you're going to make a few mistakes.
And come on then, what would you say now when you say, well, you know...
I thought the our big mistake was the second album, She Loved Like Diamond. Yeah. And there was one good track on it called Chant Number One. The rest of it...
Do you know, that was, for a very brief period, that was a football chant, or that Millwall it was anyway.
Yeah.
And I thought, I don't believe in Terrace Whip, but one of the most inventive things
I've
ever heard.
I've never been to Millwall,
well, no, but for a very short period, whenever a player got injured and looked like he was all right, they would sing, "We all want the stretcher on, we all want the stretcher on, we all want the stretcher on, we all want the stretcher." And I thought, oh, that's good, yeah.
And now they're singing it in the street afterwards.
For a very short time, that was the whole album, other than Chant.
Well, it was a difficult time, you know, because for any band, your second album is hard. Because
always difficult.
Your first album, you've been practicing, you've been playing for like the year before, you know. Your second album, you're pushed into a corner and you're told, this is it, you've got to write something that's great to follow.
But it must be murder going out, and I know.
Very stressful.
When you have to do press stuff for this, I know. Not for this, but when you've done something, and you know, it's not what you want to be remembered for, but you have to sit there in an audience. I think it's the greatest thing we've ever done. And seriously, but you think it'd be easy, mate. I know, we know. And then that was the second album, was it? That's
the one of course. Yeah, I mean, that was a difficult period for us. I think even my brother, who wrote the album, will admit to that.
About in the acting department, is it you who's in the film In Love with a Horse or something?
I did do something like that.
I
thought you might mention that.
I've
done worse than that.
It's the top of the shop these days, people think, of course, they're an award-winning actor and all of this. And I often say, I think I saw a film once where he was in love with a horse.
My girlfriend was in love with a horse.
Or she was a horse or something, wasn't it?
She thought she was a horse.
Hello, I'm Mr. Redwina.
1982 or something in Australia.
Yeah, well, I rented that out. You got £1 of my money.
Well, you're more sad than I was making it. At least I got paid for it.
Yeah, there it is. All part of the rich tapestry of a CV.
Yeah.
Martin, if you could be good, be so good. Sorry to keep you hanging around just for this little list, and to reiterate again why you're here at all this morning. Need you to rattle through these. This little list here. What was the first film you ever saw?
The Godfather. That's a lie.
No, you're
the first thing to come up and think of.
Exactly.
X film I ever saw was Bruce Lee Enter the Dragon.
That was an X, so it was. Carry On Screaming was an X when it came out.
Was it? First film, I can't remember.
Come on, it's something.
First film, I can't remember. My earliest memories of a film must be St. Trinian's.
Well, that's all right.
That's good.
Happiest Days of Your Life is up in my top five films, so Happiest Days of Your Life, that's good. the first record you bought with your own money?
Me and My Life, the Tremolos.
Wow. He doesn't mind saying, I made mistakes. There you go.
Now you can see why Stand Up Valley come around.
Me and my life. What a song. It's a good song. It's not so bad at all. The Christian name of your first girlfriend?
Oh, God.
Who thought she was your first girlfriend?
I cannot remember that. I'll take a stab at... Kim.
Kim. Okay, let's put Kim there then. I think it's rather tragic, actually, right? You can remember instantly
somebody,
the Tremolos. The first girlfriend.
The Kim summer game.
All the Kims out there. All the people married to Kims are going... I wonder why you had that look of disappointment in your eyes last 20 years. And the first time you ever appeared in a production in public, what was it? What was the first thing you did?
In public, it was... I'm not very good at it.
It's got to be a school play. It's got to be.
No, it wasn't.
I was Mad Hatter in Alice in Wonderland.
I wasn't at all. It was most probably Jack and Ori with my brother.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, well, we'll dig that out for the next Four Over Famous. And lastly, the reason you're here this morning is because...
I am promoting 100 Greatest Men in Music Week, which starts on VH1 on Monday the 27th.
I know that was the last thing, but how many people on the list do you know personally? Do you think, because
a few of them, actually. Yeah, quite a few of them, and I was pretty shocked as I was doing it, the amount of people I did know, and it was quite nice. It was a nice feeling.
Would you be 101? Is that what Eric works? You're 101.
No, I don't think so.
Once again, thank you very much. The best of luck in all you do, my friend. I'm sorry, I can only apologise for 20th Century Box. We seem to have got over it now. Anyway, thank you very much indeed.
The opposite film title is The Last Morning of the Great Rock and Roll Giveaway, and there are very, very few niches, very few crags and crannies to hang on to this morning. Most great things have gone. There are no name tags we can print out. We don't think anymore that we'll get admiring glances, but you can try us out on 0207-224-2000 if you want to claim a piece of rock and roll history. But here are some of the more... These are great opposite film titles. The Great Escape, No Way Out. Shampoo, Grease. Awakenings, Sleepers. Cast a Dark Shadow, Shine. The Dresser, Striptease. I Know Where I'm Going, The Magical Mystery Tour. Local Hero, Enemy of the State. My Fair Lady, Dark Man. Parents, Kids. The Big Chill Heat We've Had, how about this? A Few Good Men, The Dirty Dozen. Very clever. But this is perhaps the top of the shop at the moment. It's a Wonderful Life. Life stinks. Very good. If you can give us the films that cancel each other out. 0207-224.
Right? London's liveliest phone in with John Jones.
We've changed the streets. Let's all cycle on slowly. Get a job. Get a life. And get out of mind.
John George, weekday mornings from 9 on BBC London 94.9.
Morning, Bubba. Mency always says, she said to me yesterday, she thinks it's funny. That man says, get a life. I don't think you should be talking about your dad on your show. That man, he says, get a life. And she giggled. And I thought, who said that? And of course, it says, listen, she was a good trail. I'm on the air.
She's obviously not listening to
you. I'm on the air for 3 hours. She enjoys the John Galt trail. Speaking of which, all the people who rang in after Mark Phelan was here yesterday doing his magic tricks and stuff and his mental games, and loads of people ringing him wanted to shoot him down. Oh, I know what he's doing there, and the thing he did about the country beginning of the day,
yeah,
they all end in that. We know that, we know. But even so, you'll never be the person who stands there going, oh, I know how that's done. You don't want to be those sort of people, do you?
Spoiling our son.
Spoilers. Like Wendy, Wendy did yesterday. I said, oh, this is how it works. I know how that works, you know. You have to think of a country that begins the day, and then think of an insect that... begins with the last letter of that country. Yeah. So that's going to be A, isn't it? And that's going to be ant. And ant leads on to T, which is tiger. And tiger as an R, which all makes people say robin. And 9 times out of 10, people do say ant, tiger, robin. I did it a couple of times yesterday and got admiring glances. It just works out like that until I came indoors. And so when did you hear that one he did at the end of the show? No, I was in Sainsbury's. Okay, well, listen, I said, think of a country apart from Afghanistan, which is in the news, that begins with the letter A. Okay, right. Now, think of an insect that begins with the last letter of that country. Okay, so now think of an animal that begins with the last letter of that insect. Okay, now think of a bird that begins with the last letter of the animal. I can't. About a robin. No, not a robin, that doesn't begin with A. So I said, A? What animal did you think of then? She said, a tarantula. I said, you're no good at these things. And I stomped indoors and sat down for a while. A tarantula, it's not an animal. Yes, it is. It's not an insect, is it? I really was one of them. So I said, what was I supposed to say then? I said, you're supposed to say tiger. She went, all right, tiger. No, come on, no, it's a trick. I know. All right, no, she said, well, do it again and I'll say tiger. No, it don't work like that. Listen to me on the radio, don't respect my talent. Okay. Up to my point.
Why would they be secret, though?
Well, they're not secret. They just sort of keep their costs very low, so they don't actually have secondary sellers. They don't...
Clandestine, something.
No, it's actually a very clever model. And there's a lot of street cred in America attached to Dell because of this new advert they've got. They have a young lad called Stephen.
Hmm.
He's called the Dude.
Okay.
And
okay, yeah.
Yeah. And people are really attracted, you know, by the clothes that the Dude wears, and they're going onto the website.
It's strapped on something like Dude got a Dell. I bet it is.
It is, yeah. Dude go out and get a Dell, yeah.
Is that what it is?
That's right.
Go out and get a Dell. How long, how many accounts and lunches was the Dude get a Dell?
Average the paper that one.
Yeah, okay. So Dell are doing okay, but I still am going to look into the story independently afterwards, because I think sometimes you try less than I do. give me the second story and I'll judge.
Okay, the second one is Gap.
Yeah.
Gap, these are the clothing retailers.
Oh, please. Yes, he's got
No. Gap reported its first quarterly profit in 9 months. stuff. Yeah,
I thought that was just, who's their competition? And they've got no competition.
Well, you see, the problem with Gap was that it really got beyond its own station. It started to sort of think that it was bigger than its customers and not really sort of delivering the goods that its customers wanted. Well,
we wouldn't know anything about that attitude around here.
No.
Okay, yeah. And so Gap overreached. Gap started flanking around. Gap stopped taking the public's calls and Gap came unstuck.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, retailing is not rocket science. I mean, you find out what your customers want.
No, well, you've got Adele explain that to people. Yeah. And so retailing, and then they're healthy now, though, eh?
They're getting better, yeah. Not quite exactly in the prime of health, but they are certainly sort of doing a lot better than they have done for the last 9 months.
Are Gap and Metamorphose next? Are Gap and Next related?
No, they're not.
Next were everywhere for a bit, and then they really just went.
Well, this is it, you see. I mean, you've actually put your finger right on the problem.
That was what I did, isn't it?
They were famous for denims and khakis.
Yeah.
And everybody was going around wearing their clothes.
I see.
And then all of a sudden, they decided that...
they were going to do Laura Ashley frocks.
Something like that. They started to go very trendy. And people of our age group, Danny, and me...
I wouldn't deny that. Even though eternally you are a millennial in spiritual terms, we understand this.
We started to shy away from Gap, and we never went in their shops again, because they never offered what we really wanted.
You mean Next?
Gap.
Oh. I'm following that story, reading Next. So what happened to Next? They did the same thing.
Next are slightly more focused. But you think...
In Lewisham Shopping Centre, which is the motif for most of the people, flagship shopping centres. In Lewisham Shopping Centre, there used to be like two Next.
Mm-hmm.
And there were Next everywhere, rather like the coffee people. Mm-hmm. Lots of Next. And then the Next disappeared, and Gap pops up.
Yeah.
And now you see the occasional Next, but they're Gaps. I mean, Lord John and Take Six are long gone.
Well, there are Gaps in Next, are there?
There are Gaps in Next, and yeah. Lord John and Take That, they went. Peter Stuyvesant, no, that was a cigarette, wasn't it? But the Next, there was everywhere was Next, and then there's only a few Next. Now, did they do that on purpose, or did they overreach?
Next are doing very well. I mean, they had some results out yesterday that showed the growth was slowing, but it was still quite strong.
And Gap are on the up.
Gap have been on the down, and now they're actually coming back again. Oh. You see, a lot of these retailers tend to sort of forget, that the customers are all important.
Yeah.
M&S had the same problem.
Oh, no, M&S just got chronically dull. Their shops started to look like their old friend Goon, which we know is Toys R Us territory. But Marks and Spencer they had the food, and they kept moving it around. Do you know Marks and Spencer's once sold edible flowers in their food department, and I bought some. They did, they had like big poppies. Nothing, no drug reference. They had big poppies and chrysanthemums, and they had sold them.
What did they taste like?
Just like flowers. There's probably a person out there who hasn't tried to eat a petal. When you're a kid, you eat a petal. They're kind of sour, aren't they? They're like bitter. They're bitter. And it was bitter flowers. Marks and Spencer really did sell edible flowers in their salad department. No, son, you say, oh, yeah, flowers everyone's doing, like your shirt pepper. And they edible flowers. And that's when they started going wrong, because they poisoned their public with the edible flowers. And they were, and then you go to Marks, I'm sorry, David, we're still doing the financial news. You go to Marks and Spencer's, and this is how it used to be. And you'd find something you like. They'd do, potatoes with popcorn. There'd be a tub of mashed potato, and in there was some popcorn. You thought, that's very clever, that's very nice. 2 weeks later, you go back, oh, no, it's discontinued.
Yeah.
Or they'd move it. And I can't walk three more aisles away. I'm not doing that. I'm not doing the three more aisles trek. And so that's where Marks and Spencer's went wrong. So Gap are doing okay?
Gap are doing okay. They're going to bring back the traditional things that made them very popular.
The check shirts and stuff.
The denims and the khakis. Yeah. And they're sort of going for this slightly unfluffy style now. They're going to come back.
But they're a poor man's Timberland, aren't they?
I'm not entirely sure about that.
Well, yes, that's what we rich people say anyway. On that chuckle, his energies were extended. He'll be back again, of course, on Monday at 10 to 7, when once again we will lift the veil into the nether regions of... No, the... we nearly got through without a special reference. Nearly we did, but he's gone. And there it is, the silhouette. Good morning, David.
Good morning,
David. Last we're here. We meet on familiar ground. That's good. The hidden serpent in the background. Let us know we're home again. Now, yesterday, this is where everything started to go. Are you dripping sweat onto a hot plate there?
That's been my impression of a serpent.
Oh, that was a serpent. I thought some kind of perspiration was hitting a hot plate. But yesterday we discussed the oddest currency in the world, which is the red feather. No, I'm not. The red feather currency of where was that?
The Solomon Isles.
In the Solomon Isles.
Mm.
Where they still talk pigeon. They talk pigeon. I used to have a fantastic little jingle that I've lost over the years, whereby they would literally, this sounds almost cartoon-like, I know, but there would literally be a log being banged by two sticks. You're listening to the Solomon Islands broadcasting on Metacycle 632, where we speak in both English and pidgin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know any pidgin, but I enjoy the pidgin language when I can. But anyway, so it was their money is made out of red feathers. I'm right, aren't I, though?
Absolutely, yeah. The red feathers of the honey-eating bird.
Ah, you didn't tell us that yet, did you?
I never got a chance to.
No, you didn't know. I suddenly did. I was going to get profane on the show. I did burst into song, and I apologise for that. So let us turn then towards the more matters. I know, it's not going to be like yesterday. I can't help it. I used it all up yesterday. And I won't lie to you, I had a few post-show cocktails. What is happening in the world of finance?
In the world of finance, we have Dell. Now, Dell doesn't quite have the status of being a bellwether of the technology technology sector.
No, since I went down market and went from Derek to just being Dell, I think people don't. But who are they?
Dell are the computer makers. They're the people that make those.
That's
really
Dell.
Dell.
Okay.
Dell.
Yeah. Dell.
But nonetheless, it's still quite an important weather amongst weathers. So it is the world's number two. It is the world's number two. It used to be number one briefly.
Dell.
Yeah, Dell Computers.
D-double-L. I know, I'm aware of the word. Looking at me like I'm a child. I'm just trying to think of a filthy limerick. So Dell? Okay, so Dell was number two. I wouldn't have known that.
Dell sell about 10% of the world's computers, so they're quite important out there.
With a D?
D, yes, Dell.
Not like Packard Dell. It's on their own. And we've established they've got nothing to do with Hewlett-Packard, which is the biggest breaking financial story of the year.
It's
so what's the matter with them now?
Absolutely nothing. They're doing very well. I mean, people were having sort of great thoughts about, you know, what Dell is actually sort of doing and how its business is.
It seems a very vague story. People are thinking about a big company.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, they watch these results very closely. And Dell last night sort of said that sales were holding up.
Yeah.
But Dell has a very interesting business model in that it uses just in time. It produces the computers that you order just at the moment you want them. So you place the order, it's got all the components there, bangs them all together, and then it ships them out to you.
Oh, I see. So like Wendy Burgers have the... seriously, like Wendy Burgers have the advantage over McDonald's. Even though Wendy's nearly went out of business.
Mm-hmm.
You can go in there and build your hamburger rather than have the pre-packaged.
Very much the same, yeah.
And that's doing good for them, is it?
It is doing them very well.
I've never heard of them. And I never see them in Dixon's. I never see them anywhere.
Well, you wouldn't, because they have this direct-to-customer model, so that you actually sort of order on the website.
Why would there be secret, though?
Mm-hmm. And I was looking at this sort of Pixar-Disney partnership,
mm-hmm.
and it is probably the most incredible partnership ever.
Why? Is nothing written down on paper?
No. It's because they're making so much money.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay, but the way you led the story in is if they're going to get rid of Pixar at the end of this next two deals.
Well, this is a very interesting point. Will the partnership dissolve after the seven movies?
It will. You know why? Because they're going to shop around and they go over to DreamWorks. Pixar will go. They'll go where the market asks them to. That's what they'll do, David.
Well, this is it, you see.
I'm learning much. I'm coming on well. Call me Grasshopper. Would you just one? Just call me Grasshopper once.
Go Grasshopper.
Thank you very much, sir. You see, now I'm learning. I'm now learning. They're going where the market is, Master. That's right. And?
And the question is, mm-hmm. with a successful partnership like Pixar and Disney, will they chance it and sort of go elsewhere?
Uh-huh.
Will Disney, for instance, team up with DreamWorks? Mm-hmm. Will Pixar find another person or another company to finance its project?
I've got an email here having a go at you.
No.
I hope you're not paying David for more than £1 an hour.
that is what the market reflects his talent. He says, all his predictions have always been wrong.
What predictions are these?
He says, I quote, the Bank of England rate decision predictions on John Gaunt's show a long time ago. Completely wrong. Send him up a chimney, would you? That's from Eddie in Kennington. All your predictions are wrong. If you really believe in market forces, you're not even worth a pound an hour. On this email, sent to Margaret.Rutherford, subject, pound an hour. It says your predictions are always wrong. In market terms, you're not worth the paper you're printed on.
That's from you, isn't it, Dad?
No, it isn't. I've no idea you make predictions about the Bank of England issue rate decision.
It's your nom de plume.
I nom de plume. If I have one.
Yeah.
But anyway, this fella says you're not worth a pound an hour. I think you are, David. Of course I do.
Do you think I'm worth more than that?
I think it was for purely entertainment value alone. Because I believe once the world has arrived at a socialist utopia, people like yourself will be put on display to make speeches like this. entertain the troops. That's exactly what we do here every morning, but I'm just a conduit for them. So Pixar has the best contract in the world.
Well, Pixar and Disney are forming probably one of the best partnerships, and I sort of see this partnership as being a bit like rice and pickles, you know?
Go on.
Yeah, because Disney is the rice, providing the carbohydrates in the form of money. Yeah. And
is there any way of playing that dong sound pickle so I can take a few quid off him here? If it was
rice
dong.
And pickles.
Rice and pickles. Yeah.
Disney
pickles
have
the spice. Pickles have had the spice, don't they?
As long as they're fair trade pickles.
They're not fair trade pickles.
Who eats rice and pickles?
I eat rice and pickles.
Yeah,
but
these are analogies.
Rice and pickles. Just because you don't eat rice and pickles.
Yeah, but this is
too personal an analogy.
Come on, BBC funded statement. I'm going to say, because I really feel ICI's share prices these days are like my wife's pink bedroom slippers. And we go, why not? Say, because they've got a hole in the bottom, of course. They're worn. And we go, huh? They go, oh, come on, everyone's heard of my wife's pink bedroom slippers.
What are you talking about? Rice and pickles. Maybe cheese and pickles, but rice and pickles?
No, cheese doesn't have the same carbohydrates as rice. Rice is a staple food of half the population in the world.
Milk pudding is.
Oh, for goodness sake.
No, rice and pickles. It's such an odd. You like rice and pickles? You're a troublemaker. No one's ever heard of them. What pickles?
Not Branston pickles.
They're like dill pickles.
What, like Big Wally?
Big Wally? Is that what you're saying? What are you saying?
I'm just saying
ordinary plain boiled rice. I mean, what pickles is it? That's what we need to
know.
Yeah. What type of pickle lily?
Pickle lily?
Mm. You know, just sort of pickled turnips.
Pickled turnips? What?
No.
What?
Does it really? No.
Does it really matter what pickles they are?
It does. To get to the base of the greatest financial alliance on the planet, and you're saying it doesn't matter.
It's just an analogy.
I said you've introduced this analogy. And now we pressed you on it. You're saying it doesn't matter, does it?
Do you mean Wilfred Pickles?
Plainly, he doesn't mean Wilfred Pickles. Plainly, he doesn't.
I didn't mean Wilfred Pickles. I just meant pickles. No. You know the pickles you buy from the supermarket, the Chinese supermarket?
The dog who found the World Cup in 1966.
Yeah.
Pickles.
Yeah. Used to be a judge pickles.
Maybe he's absolutely right. What he meant is rice, absolutely base, and gold. That's what you meant.
And likewise,
that isn't what I meant at all.
That's why I allow him to call me Grasshopper. So rice and pickles.
Yeah. The Pixar-Disney partnership I see personally as a rice and pickles partnership, right? Where
you're not going to get this phrase off the ground. That's all you say. Nobody is going to enter the square miles of this. They are sort of a rice and pickles there, isn't it? Nobody. No one's going to adopt this. And then some, you know, future historian tracing it back to you. You're not going to... there's no way you're going to get rice and pickles T-shirts out at the end of the year. No one's going to use this phrase. It's absolutely endemic to you and nobody else.
No, it's a commonly used phrase in our household, you know? It's like
rice in your household. Mind you, we have a slightly wider audience than we've got in your kitchen. So it's a rice and pickles relationship. And
yeah, that's right. Can you see the analogy there?
No,
yeah?
Don't start again.
But anyway...
They're the carbohydrates, so therefore Pixar...
are the pickles, yeah?
Adding
the spice, the flavor to the partnership. So one provides the energy in the form of money, the marketing, the distribution, and the other provides the excitement that pickles do to plain boiled rice. Yeah?
Is it time? Yeah. Even twisting in the wind.
I think it is.
Was there going to be a second story today?
There would have been Weight Watchers, yeah.
up at the balloon at Weight Watchers. And they've gone up from... this.
Taking the dogs across the street to a grassy space between the buildings, watching your shadow, kept by the street light.
You're listening to 94.9 in Florida Keys, where we do things nice and key.
Yeah, that's summing up the mood of the room. I'm thinking that's why it's getting an airing again, Dave. It's been a long time since we played that, but, you know, in this weather, that's exactly what we should be looking for. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Candyman.
I think I've been too harsh yesterday. I gave you £140 and you didn't quibble. So just to show you the ball can bounce by the way, I'm bringing you down to £99.
Thank you very much.
I'm unclear actually where we are, but £99 it is.
It's a very important psychological figure, 99.
Is it? Go on, why?
Well, I don't know.
Of course, the price point, as they say, is
the price point.
It is, £14.99, £11.99. You're quite right. Dave, you know how you can tell if somebody, and I won't lie to you, David, I had quite a few cold drinks with a fellow station presenter, Danny Kelly, yesterday. We met for a superb lunch at Passione there in Charlotte Street. My agent was in tow, and the three of us were hail fellow well met, and 5 hours later were still sluicing and browsing. And but how you can tell a gentleman has had quite a good day the previous week? David, you know how?
Oh, go on then.
So much change. I can't have proper change for any single drink the whole day. I must have just whipped out notes every time. I've got so much. Pockets weighed down this morning. All pound coins as well. Every time. Why on earth do men can't be bothered to go, well, here's the right money. Now fivers, tenners, twenties. I've got no notes at all. So much change.
No, I do that. I always make sure I have the right money.
Ah, dear. Really?
I do, yeah.
I'm surprised by this, Mark.
I expect you to haggle as well.
And now, I'm not going to get bogged down here because we need to get the stories out. And they're always really good when we truncate them. But I just wonder, and I'm going to ask Mark to refrain from it. But you, I know you like to keep the score of the two financial cultures in the world come to clash. When the two sevens clash, when Mark and David log, you know, they come to loggerheads over how... The workplace should be arranged, and the political struggle. They're at either end of the political struggle.
Yeah.
But while you're away, I
struggle of class against class.
Yeah, political struggle. But while you're away, and David with a straight battle played it. We were talking about this. You know, going to get the fair trade bananas and fair trade coffee now.
Oh yeah.
And David made that noise when I met him. Mm. I really dislike that because when you get these fair trade things coming in, it just upsets the market. And I'm quite right there, David. They're not good for the market, these fair trade things, and they're playing on sentiment, aren't they?
They are definitely playing on sentiment. You know that's true.
Well, no, all I'm saying is, you know, because it says, look, here, this is from the Windward Islands, who don't get a look in because the banana market is locked up between, like, Argentina and Britain. Yeah. But here they are, this will give the people in the Windward Islands a little trade if you just buy these bananas. Well, that's all very good in sentiment, isn't it? But it upsets the market, doesn't it?
Well, it does upset the market. I'll give you an example. You know, recently there's been all this sort of talk about companies relocating their operations from the UK... Into India,
all centres are going to India, yeah.
Well, that's right.
Yeah.
And the unions in this country are complaining that all these workers are going abroad, and what is going to happen to the call centres here? What are going to happen to the jobs?
Yeah.
And if you really analyse the problem, it is because wages are too high over here, and they are cheaper abroad. Uh-huh. And so therefore...
I'm paying attention. Yes,
yeah.
Wages are too high.
The wages are too high over here, and so therefore, in order for the companies to make more profits, they are moving overseas.
That's your mortal soul, though.
It's not my mortal soul.
Mm-hmm. These people are just trying to earn a few quid, and you're saying it's no good for the market.
Well, you see, I mean...
What's the first story this morning, Dave? I'm just open to new ideas. I'm just watching... as if there wasn't enough steam coming off Mark already.
I get you asking to refrain, and I have.
And he has. So, Dave, what's the first story you have for us this morning?
Okay, did you know that Pixar...
Yeah.
These are the people who make those animated...
Oh, there goes Mark. Oh, it's something. He has boiled up and we're now taking him outside to fan him down. Yeah, Pixar, who makes the films, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. Now, they only have two more movies with Disney.
Yeah.
And then that's it. Their contract is over.
Well, it will be renegotiated again, is what you're thinking.
Well, I'm not entirely sure about that.
Well, they've just delivered Disney's, like, six number one films and they're going to part company.
Five. They've only delivered five.
Well, okay, yeah, well.
Yeah, five.
Yeah.
Toy Story 2. Oh,
yeah.
Bugs Life.
Monsters, Inc. And now Nemo.
And Finding Nemo, that's right.
In all the reviews, and in stark contrast, the Geely is supposed to be what the cinema was invented for. It says there's moments, I've read reviews that said there are moments in the new Pixar film when you are absolutely transfixed and whisked away to a place you haven't been since you were 5 years old and first seen Dumbo or whatever. Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right.
Absolutely staggering.
Yeah, it is. There are two more movies in the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is called The Incredibles.
Okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And the last one will be called Cars.
Okay.
Yeah. So far, it's just
a project at the moment. Cars, isn't it? That's a working title. It's not going to be called Cars, is it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, Cars sounds pretty good to me.
Okay.
But The Incredibles, I think, will be the title of the next movie.
Rubbing our hands together, it is still the fallout from the whole Roy Keane stamping his foot and having a private plane sent him to bring him home from the greatest football competition in the world because he doesn't want to take part anymore. So off he goes.
That's right. Because it all started because he didn't want to play in goal. During a five-a-side game.
Oh, all of a sudden.
Yeah, goalkeeping coach Paddy Bonner said, I've had the goalkeepers out, and they've been out early. Now they're going to go off and have a bit of a rub down.
Now, I think...
So you left a little five-a-side scrimmage. Roy, just stand in goal for a second, only use your feet.
And Roy said, do you know who I am?
In goal.
Really? But here's the thing. If he had publicised this angle more, we knew it was about Paddy Bonner, we didn't know what the deal was. If it really is because he didn't want to go in goal, then a lot of people are going to come round to him and say, that's the same. You know,
I don't want to go in goal.
No, but they're all sitting in cast now and stuff, and they're all saying to each other, yeah, well, you're a bit like that, George. And they go, oh, no, you never want to go in goal. A lot of people will be able to understand that. And the thing is, you can get into a terrible row.
I don't want to go in goal. And then there's a little table with all the Lucasfilm drinks on. And he put one on. He ran along it and threw it all on the floor. And I'm not going in goal.
Well, all of a sudden, I'm with Roy Keane on this one. I used to like going in goal. I speak to somebody. I used to love going in goal. But I can understand, because we all know at least half a dozen people who never go in goal and throw the shot. And you think, well... That's all right.
The key is, of course,
where he's showing his naivety, the key is to go in goal and be useless.
Yeah.
I'll come out again if you're going to do that. And then you go, that's always what they're doing.
Yeah, when they're only playing three and in, he wouldn't have been in for long.
He wouldn't have been in for long. You just let him go in, that's it.
Yeah.
He should have used his head there, but anyway, carry on.
But he didn't, yes.
Good morning, Colin.
Morning.
Colin, thank you for hanging on, Colin. Now, it's not the runner, and we're not celebrating runners in any way, shape, or form, and I mean that.
Yeah.
And but it's the incredible, exquisite thrill of that moment when everyone goes, should we do a runner? And we've all got, you know, we're all well healed even at the time, and you think, oh no, they're going to do it, and you get swept along with the thing. But I've never instigated one, and I don't think you have, Colin. But you've been involved, am I right?
Yes, that's right.
All right, well, I've got the map here. Where was it?
It was in Birmingham at the Hagley Road.
We've gone north, that's okay. He's living in the map of Britain.
Birmingham, that's all right, yeah.
Okay, Birmingham.
It was always, like you, it was about mid to late 70s.
Yeah, okay.
And we were out on a stag night. There was about 10 of us.
Hmm.
And we were at a place, I think it was called the Dill Shed, and as they always are.
Yeah.
And one of the lads came back, he went to the toilet and he came back and he said, we can do a runner from here. And I said, why? And he said, well,
because we can.
He said, when you go to the toilet, he said, they put the fire exit door in the middle of the urinals in the toilet. So that when you went out, if you flicked the fire door at the back, it opened out into open ground, which was like flat.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, it's easy.
Yeah, but it does sound as if they should have pointed out when you're coming, are you paying this evening, sir? Then leave by the front. If you're not paying, could you please leave through the toilets over there?
That's right.
Convenient. Yeah, and
there was and he said, what we'll do is we'll go out in twos. And he said, not to arouse suspicion.
Yeah, that's right.
People, and there's like 10 of us gradually going out. So we all go out and to make out as if we go to the toilet in twos. And we all split up. One flicked the door open, and it was dark, and we just dashed out the door, and we realised, as soon as a couple of us got out, that the ground suddenly dropped away in a great drop, and it was like a rubbish chip we'd run out on. And we had to jump out.
Oh, this was a cut in the opening meal, yeah?
Yeah, I know. And we got out, and there was a gate, and we had to... leg it over this gate, and we upturn this gate. It's about 6 foot high, this gate. And
all the while behind you, can hear,
and we got over the gate, and it was me and my mate, and we got behind the fence. Ah, oh, that's all cut. Nobody coming. We're okay. So we shot down the road. And we crouched in a corner in the dark.
Yeah.
And then we're waiting. And then we realised that a couple of people were seeing get over the fence. And they went a different way. And each group that came out seemed to appear to go a different way. So we shouted a couple. And it was about five of us met up. And we lost the others. And we thought, oh, well, I'll meet up later. So we went back to the flat where we were. We managed to get a cab and get back to the flat. Mm-hmm. We're sitting there at about 3 a.m, having another couple of beers and stuff. And a knock comes on the door. And we'd lost one of our lads, you see, and we didn't know what had happened. And he turns up, and all he's got is a shirt on and a pair of trousers and a pair of, old shoes on.
Yeah.
And we said, what happened to you? And he said, I've got to go back. I've got to go back. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, I turned right, didn't I, instead of left. And he said, I missed the toilet and I ended up in the cellar. And these two Indian blokes cornered me. And they started beating me with sticks and slapping me. He said, I had to give him my watch, my shoes. He said, I'm wearing the waiter's shoes. And he said, they've got my jacket, my tie. And he says, because I ain't got any money. And I said, I've got to go back on the promise.
And then the rest of you said, go on, you go back. I mean, you wouldn't have helped him at all, surely, did you?
Yeah, we did. We all had a whip round them.
You see, if there's anything, send Colin a pound, definitely. But if there's anything comes out of these stories, you see, I'm not being pixious, instigating the runner stories. If there's a moral in there, I think that the under 15 are hearing, the thrill is there, but it's simply not worth it. You'll end up in the cellar being beaten with coal fumes. And it only comes to £3. There are £3 each. No, I think I'll take the beating with Paul Hughes lying in the cellar. The option. But they take away my shoes. And you have to go home in the waiter's shoes.
Well, the staff did a runner.
It's already good. You could leave it there and it's on the list. Where was this?
Well, it was in a curry house near the Palladium.
Yeah.
Just before Christmas. We're out on a bit of a work to do. There's 8 of us. We've got a small office and we said, let's all go up to town.
Yeah.
One of our clients was treating us to a drink up.
Mm.
And eventually, of course, you get to the situation where you need a curry. So we're in the curry house. Lovely starter. Yeah. Lovely main course. Then the staff seemed to be a little bit scarce. One of them was a rather nice young girl, and there's a few other waiters in there as well. They're all pretty polite. But we wanted to order a dessert, but there was no one around. And we thought, forget this. So we've done the whip round, got all the money on the table.
Mm.
I nip off to the loo, get my coat, come back, and all hell is breaking loose.
Yeah.
Because the staff are chasing the manager through the shop, Benny Hill style, cuffing him about the ear. There's a whole trying to leapfrog each other to get the slap in, and they're chasing her into the street.
And the staff did a runner.
Chased the manager out of the street. Anyway, it turns out because a couple of the manager never showed up, but the staff came back, got their coat and said, we're off. And we're going, what's happening?
you're sitting trying to entertain a young lady or something. What a high class joint.
He's a terrible man. They said he's been, trying to have his wicked way with
the waitress you spotted earlier.
And we're not having it.
And they chased him out into the street
Him out, administering cuffs as they went.
Well, you see, I mean, there's nothing like hot-headed and insane restaurant staff. As I say, when I saw the big six-foot spatula across the crown, squarely, but even that doesn't rival the actual staff doing a runner from the restaurant. Top of the shop, Brian, thank you very much indeed.
Are you a friend of Nick Hucknall?
I've met him a few times.
Why do people always pick on him?
Because he's big and successful, like Phil Collins, like anyone, if you want to, he makes perfectly serviceable music for the masses. And also he's got an absolutely staggering, fantastic, brilliant voice. Unbelievable voice Nick Hucknall has, and I think people overlook that in his other areas. But when he does sing, man alive, that's none of your pop idol. He pours down like silver.
Do you think people pick on him because he's ginger?
No, I think it's because he's successful, opinionated, handsome, and beds lots of supermodels, and thinks he's the top thing in the world. He is. I'll tell you what he's like. I know we're not for you, but that's what I say. But for me, he's handsome. But when you meet Nick Hucknall, and it's a bit like Gather,
People think, oh, AirTip. No, exactly. Everyone says that about gas. Everyone says, oh, this. But when you meet, and I swear to God, people will call in with certainly this station. When you meet Paul, he's every bit an athlete. And people think, no, he's not. He's a great big northern fat. No, it's not. And there's something animal about it. It just is. I mean, I have got passed over in this. You know, you see me, I look exactly the same as I do on the telly. But, and all that goes with it. But Mick Hucknall and Gazza, I've seen it happen. Anyway, it's a travel story.
He's offering some showbiz teeth for us in the form of Charles Laughton in The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Oh, that lovely half set with a declining, declining incisors.
Very nice.
Wonderful.
Very nice.
She gave me water.
Oh, what a set of teeth. And of course, it came with a false eye as well. We're not going into the full facial makeup.
That's true. It was enormous as well, wasn't it?
Once an actor gets here, enormous. It was up here, wasn't it? It was
actually a huge eye stuck in the
north and south of the eyes, wasn't it? One home, one away, as they used to say.
She gives me water.
We had a friend who wasn't, you know, he'd been hit with the ugly stick several times. And when he finally got a girlfriend, that's all we could say to him. And it's just like,
you know, so cruel.
No, he'd come back and say, so, you know, he was all about 16, and he, you know, on the estate, we all kind of had lots and lots of girls, and then finally somebody went out with him. And as he walked back through the flat with a spring in his step, we all went,
she gave me water.
That's so cool.
And then, you know, she gave me water last night. After all, he looked like you will with the dancing colours.
The dancing thing,
she came to accept it. Where'd you go out last night? Oh, me and she gave me water, went to the pictures. His girlfriend was called.
She gave me water.
Anyway, a great one. That's
okay. So Steve Harvey came in yesterday.
Right.
And he was great. And he was great. And everyone said, oh, we're good. And I do hope, because I sincerely believe that Steve Harvey, especially in the first two Cockney Rebel albums, which are mad, blowsy, insane, overblown, and brilliant, will happen. But I'm going to say, there was everyone asking, with a few people who asked me about him yesterday. And I said, yes, how are you looking? I said, great. And I thought I'd do this now. But the last time I saw Steve, you see, he was on one of their other lists. People who, over the last 25 years, we, the public, have had pleasure seeing go bald. You see.
And he was on that list.
He was. The last time I saw
Steve. He's not on that list now.
Well, here's the thing. I didn't even say it to us, because I like Steve. We're great, and I genuinely believe he's fantastic. But I've never had that. Well, once since I left school, I already had the experience of running into someone who wasn't bald anymore.
Mm.
And when Steve walked in here yesterday, you see, Steve, how are you? Fantastic. Mm. I couldn't help but look above his eyebrows, and as I looked above his eyebrows, there it was. The hairpiece. And this is the music, I don't know why, I heard in my head. this noise. Here. Whoa! It comes again there. As he walked in, yeah. Steve, how you doing? It's fantastic. Great to see him. But there's not, you know, man to man, there's nothing I could say. Because as he walked in, I heard that. Just that. And I sort of get it out of the way now because I'm sharing it with the 6 o'clock show people. But it's an extraordinary thing when he walked in the room. I mean, what do you do? It was an Elton John style wheeze. But it was a full overall.
I never spotted it.
No. Didn't you?
No. I sat right next to me the whole time. I never spotted it.
As he walked in. That's all I could hear. We were just babbling. Oh, yeah, but sit down. This is in my head. I'm just looking at this thing. I don't know why this music, but I recorded it out of my head last night. So, and this, particularly this bit. That particular noise I heard. And so I'm just sharing that with you earlier. Because we weren't going to do it later in case Steve's still in and he listens. That's the thing. Yeah. But yeah. It's very, very tricky. They don't teach you that at school, how to handle that. You know, they should have a little section on that Friends Reunited that says, if you do ever run into, you know, old school friends, you may find yourself. Here it comes. Here it comes again. It's this particular one coming up, so. And we'll be joined after 8 o'clock, said by Steve Harley. And he walked into the room, and all of a sudden. But anyway, good morning, everybody. These are words invented by Shakespeare. They didn't exist before Shakespeare's plays. There's a pretty good list, this. Alligator. Invented by Shakespeare.
Alligator?
Yeah. Before the bard, it was known in English as legato. In Romeo and Juliet, he said, in his needy shop, a tortoise hung, an alligator stuffed, another skin. First time the word alligator was ever used. How about it? Dawn. The verb dawning for daybreak is gifted. Shakespeare turned it into a noun. Henry V. Next day after dawn, doth rise and help Hyperion to his horse.
Lonely, invented by Shakespeare. He had a D-L-Y. I go alone, like a lonely dragon. Never been used that way before. Drug, you invented by Shakespeare. Changed it into a verb, gave it the negative connotation it has today from Macbeth. I have drugged their deposit. Eyeball. The words eye and ball existed, but Shakespeare put them together. Midsummer Night's Dream. Make his eyeballs roll with wanted light. Shakespeare invented these words.
Good Lord.
Undress. Taming of the Shrew. Undress you and come to bed now. Shakespeare invented the word. Puke. As we probably know, puke, mewling and puking in the nurse's arms. Absolutely, from a quarter, as you like it. Domineering. Shakespeare adapted this word from the Dutch domineren. Nobody had heard it in England before. A domineering pedant. Oh, the boy in love's labour's lost. Inaudible. All's well that ends well. We are told on our, and on our quickest decrees, the inaudible noiseless foot of time. Invented that word too. Amazement. Invented, if you are amazed at all this, amazement is invented by Shakespeare. Wild amazement hurries up, hurry up the dawn, the down, the little number of you doubtful friends in King John. Leapfrog.
Leapfrog.
The game was known but didn't have a name. Leapfrog is Shakespearean.
That's
invented the word.
Invented that word.
Huh?
It's a lovely word.
Yeah, invented it. Here it is, leapfrog. In Henry V, if I could win a lady at leapfrog, I should quickly leap into a wife. There you go, leapfrog. Bedroom, invented by Shakespeare. Midsummer Night's Dream, then by your side, no bedroom me deny. Never been heard before Shakespeare. What a list. Hint. Shakespeare took the Middle English verb hint and used it as a noun. I should teach him how to tell my story, and that would woo her. Upon his hint, I spake in Othello. Lastly, submerge. He combined the Latin sub with the Latin word amnesia, merger, to plunge, to create in Antony and Cleopatra. Half my Egypt was submerged and made.
Well,
how about that? I mean, you know.
He was slightly hard of hearing and heard everything.
I think he was a genius. He may have been a genius. Alligator, dawn, lonely drug, eyeball, undress, puke, domineering, inaudible, panda. Oh, panda, I left out. Amazement, leapfrog, bedroom, hint, and submerge.
That's extraordinary.
I know. Along with 800 others, it says. But, 800. Yeah, but those are the more notable.
Hi, Denny.
You thought your parents were going to kill you. What happened, Mark?
Well, as younger kids, me and my younger brother, you know, you sort of see sports events on the telly and you sort of go make up the game and then reenact it, you know.
I've just remembered something. Yes, yes, indeed, yes.
Well,
yes.
For us, it was the Winter Olympics that did it.
Right.
And
and where were you living?
I was living in Newcastle at the time.
Okay,
yeah. So we had bunk beds at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I had the top bunk, my younger brother had the bottom bunk.
Good for you, well done.
And we had a ladder.
Yeah.
That I used to use to get up to bed.
Yeah.
Well, it struck us that would make a pretty good bobsleigh.
But the ladder? Oh, they're coming down the ladder,
well,
as you would.
We took the ladder off, and we took it onto the landing at the top of the stairs.
The sleigh itself, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, and we sat on it. And we had to sort of shuffle forward until the balance got right. And then up we went down the staircase. Tremendous
way. I could see that now. I'm thinking, oh, yeah, I could see that.
It works.
Hanging on to the rung. And away you go, yeah.
We had absolutely no chance of stopping. There was a cabinet at the bottom of the stairs that had the telly and... not the telly, the telephone and... books and what have you in it.
Sounds like our passage, yeah.
Demolished.
But see, the thing is, once you set off, it's only when you're about halfway down, you say, we're stopping things. Any ideas?
No chance.
You're brave, man.
Any suggestions?
It was worse for my younger brother, because I'd made him sit on the front. I told him it was aerodynamic. With the big fella at the back.
The bobsleigh down the stairs. That's an indoor game. That is a tremendous thing. Reading Stephen Wright last night. And there's a Stephen Wright thing about he bought a cheap watch. Doesn't have any fives on it. And his friend said, how long have you had it? And he said, I don't know, my calendar has no sevens. I'm ringing the entire list one morning, we just rattle through them. I don't know, my calendar has no sevens. He went on a submarine, it didn't have a periscope, it had a kaleidoscope. He thought he was surrounded. The thing with Stephen Wright jokes. The thing with Stephen Wright jokes is you think, of course, that's been sitting there, that joke. Of course it is, kaleidoscope, periscope. Yeah, but he's the one. He's the only one who pulls them out of the air.
One of the things he did, we are trying to spot the actual records that have the Tasty Brothers on them. The best example of this so far has been Keep the Customer Satisfied with Simon and Garfunkel. At the end, those fellas blow their livers out through their trumpets, which is the Tasty Brothers trademark. We've had the Van Morrison album that seems to happen very early on. About a minute into the concert, they rip off their beards and reveal themselves. And, of course, this very good spot by Dave over the weekend, who called us and said, what about Robbie Williams' Let Me Entertain You? They seem to be taking over the whole last minute of the record. And as you hear...
that they'll become apparent in a minute. They're just getting warmed up. It's the Tasty Brothers meet Robin Williams. Now here they go. Where you go, fellas? And if you've got a copy of that, it goes on for about another minute after that. Any other examples you can give us, we'll always find them. I know, but the Tasty Brothers are, unfortunately, despite our meagre efforts every morning, they're the stars of the show. So welcome aboard, everybody. The teeth thing has just reached a new... Is it apogee? Is that the word I'm after? Is it an apogee? Brand new heights here, because Mark, keeping the powder under two industrial dryers in the middle of the Sahara, suddenly says, perhaps, this is okay for the list. What did you say?
The Hydra's teeth.
From Jason and the Argonauts, the Hydra's teeth. Which, of course, form the army of the dead.
When he gets the guy's helmet and he digs them out and you get them rattling away in there.
And he walks along doing that very pronounced, very, you know, the thing is, if you've not seen this, Amy, there's it's the climax of the film. And the Argonauts and Jason are shaping up to have this battle. And this one fellow who's wearing a very pronounced beard suddenly says, can we hold up before you?
King, who did they steal the fleece from? King, or come to
the end of it. Kong. No, it's not. It wouldn't be Kong.
Creole.
There's the film. Oh, we might be some great kings tomorrow. The king list begins tomorrow, everyone. The king list. He's got this hat full of the Hydra's teeth. And he does this odd walk and a very determined, while this battle's raging, everyone stops, huh? What's he doing? And just starts scattering them like he's a medieval farmer. And then the ground starts to rumble, and skeletons emerge holding shields and swords wherever the Hydra teeth
go. Straight up.
And whatever else people like laugh about the old goofy effects and everything, they are perfectly realised, though.
Oh, yeah. Ray Harryhausen.
How about the twin harpies when he's in the Acropolis? Don't stop me on that. That's gone straight in at number two, the Hydra teeth. You're slinky and wild, you've got the teeth of the Hydra upon you. So that list is now almost complete, I think. I don't know. Now we've got that, the teeth of the Hydra. What do you know, Alex? Is it a late entry? Is this the updated list? Okay, so Alec Guinness and the Lady Killers. Mr. Rumbold from Are You Being Served? Was his teeth particularly...
Yes, he did have an overbite.
Yes, he had an overbite. Okay, Harry Enfield's... Oh, yeah, Harry Enfield's Tim Nice, but they're great teeth. Those are Dick Emery's teeth, aren't they?
Yeah, those are very straight.
Dick Emery's teeth. Dustin Hoffman in Marathon Man, very useful just for the teeth scene. Mike Myers, Austin Pickle. Well, Mike Myers, Austin Powers.
Of course, Austin Powers.
Father Jack in Father Ted, tremendous teeth.
Very good teeth.
Horrible teeth. The Monster in Alien, of course. Catherine Thomas, tremendous. Dick Emery's Vicar, we've already spoken about. Les Patterson. I've had a whopper thrown at me. That's what he's crying. Oh, the good Lord's been blessed me down in that department. I've had a real whopper thrown at me. And there isn't a woman at this State Department's eyes that don't light up when that old Les's hand goes in his pocket. Paul Fellini's been hanging on ages because in response to have you ever affected a foreign accent for profit, gain or other reasons. Paul, are you still there?
Yes, I'm
still. I do appreciate that, Paul. Thank you. We'll send you one of our mounted pounds, and they are very, very good things. Extraordinary. Paul, what have you got for us?
Right. I pretended to be an American for the best part of a year to convince a group of American students I was American.
The best part of a year?
Best part of a year.
And so are you all waking hours, you had to affect an accent. Firstly, give us a certain sense.
Let me tell you the story, then you'll see. 1972.
Yeah.
I'm in town with a friend of mine, walking through the West End, and we're just messing about. I'm speaking American, he's speaking English. Yeah. He walked into, I think it was Lord Kitchener's Valet in Piccadilly Circus,
yeah.
And there was about 6 or 7 American students just standing nearby us looking at stuff.
Yeah.
And one of them turned around to me and asked me if I knew where something was. And I carried on talking in American.
So let's reenact that moment. Can you still do it? I mean, supposing I said, excuse me, do you know where I can pick up a pizza around here? I know the time frame's wrong. And you said...
Yeah, I know, I can tell you.
That's what I'm saying.
I could only do poor white trash, and... So I turned around, I just carried on talking without realising I was still doing it.
Yeah.
So they said to me, oh, where are you from? And I said, and the first thing I could think of was a song I knew called Eston Colorado by a band called Dada.
Of course, yeah.
didn't even know it was a skiing resort. This just comes in later, right?
Yeah. Okay, but right. By the way, that Gaga album, they're about 65 quid.
Yes, I know, yeah. I know.
Sorry,
sadly, I haven't got any more.
Sadly, yeah, has. Sorry.
But it's the way it goes.
She's done
but, so we immediately start talking, yeah. And I think they wanted to get somewhere at Trafalgar Square or something. So they said, oh, you know, do you want to join us? And my friend and I said, yeah, fair enough. Thinking this is all right,
Now, that is the moment you should have said, by the way, I'm actually from London, I'm sorry about that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah,
that's
exactly.
When you should have bailed out. Okay.
So we spent the next 2 hours with them, wandering about, chatting and showing them stuff and whatever.
Yeah.
They invited us to come and meet them the following night. So my friends couldn't make it. He didn't want to make it. He thought he was doing something. So I said, yeah, I'll come along.
Yeah.
And I continued the story. We went to the marquee, whatever. They were doing something like a 4 or 5 European city trip for their school.
Uh-huh.
And London was the first stop.
And how, you'd had lots of conversations with them by this point in your poor white trash.
Yes. And did
none of them suspect?
No, I'd been lying. I suddenly realized what I was getting into, and I was making up histories, I was making up pasts, I was making up stuff, and it was going on and on and on and on and on, and none of them trusted it, right?
Yeah.
They were doing this European trip,
mm-hmm.
4 or 5 European cities. I was coincidentally going to go to Paris in about 4 weeks' time from that point.
Okay.
So they off, and I said goodbye. End of story.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on the metro in Paris, and one of them comes on the train and says, hi, how are you doing? I said, oh, shit.
So here's the thing. Were you were on your own on the metro?
I'm on my own, yeah.
Oh, so it would have been better if you were talking to someone in English and you had to then turn and juggle with two. That would have been fantastic.
I was sitting on my own, and one of them gets on the train at this station and immediately says, oh, how are you doing? And I said, oh, shit. Yeah, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And they were staying in this place called the City University in the South of Paris. It's a big student dormitory place.
Yeah.
So he said, you've got to come and meet all the guys. I said, oh, right, fine. So I went down with them. Right, they were there for about 2 days in Paris.
Yeah.
So we went down, had the chat, blah, blah, blah. And they said, look, on the last night, we're all getting together in this place we're staying,
mm-hmm.
and the whole trip is going to put on a series of sketches.
Yeah.
Depicting all the cities we've been to. Would you like to be an English person?
No! Oh, this is now with wheels within wheels. We're through the looking glass.
So I play an English policeman in this little sketch they do about London.
Now, be honest with me here, Paul. Did you mess the accent up at times just to say, oh, I can't quite get it and all of that? Were you good?
I must have slipped loads of times, Danny. I must have slipped in and out loads of times. But by this time, they were completely convinced.
Now, Paul, sorry to have to curtail the whole thing here because we've got to do the sport and everything else. But for how long, precisely, you said almost a year, how long precisely do you think you lived as Paul Whitetrash?
Okay, let me just tell you, I'll do these very quickly. They left, okay, I skippedly gave them my address to one or two of them. One of them wrote to me and said her family were coming back the following February to London. The family came, they stayed at Brown's Hotel in Mayfair, I met the family, they took me out to dinner, we went to the theatre, this girl's parents fell for it, when she went back, I wrote and said, look, I'm really sorry, I'm not really American, I'm just messing about. I got a really nasty letter.
Oh, did you?
I've heard of them, yeah.
Oh, well, I was going to hope you were carrying it off, because I was going to say that we still have your home address and calling around this evening to stay with you for 1 month. But I'd just like to have revisited that. How old were you when you did that? Paul?
16,
a tremendous. So there's Paul living a lie.
That is incredible.
Paul White Trash, he was. And that's exactly it. If you've got any other stories on those reactions, if you've ever been across a desert...
I've got a question for you, though. You know, we're talking about carrots, which naturally leads me to think of people with ginger hair.
Yeah.
And your mate, Chris Evans, is in the news again. Is this? Can you give us any truth in the matter? Because basically, it says that he's in talks with the Virgin Radio. Basically, he's saying... that if they kind of let him get his way
with the Scottish media group,
it says that he's going to present the Virgin Breakfast Show.
It depends who Chris is talking to. If he gets a call and says, is that right, Chris? He'll say, yep, that's right. That's exactly what I'm going to do. The thing is, it's smoke and mirrors. No chance at all.
So
he listens to this all the time. I'm joking. Listening probably now and thinks, damn, I miss doing that. And probably after, you know, he had a couple of post-evening, you know, he goes out to the pictures every night, post-cinema cocktails. And weeping into his handkerchief, decided to tell Bill, I'm going back to work. I'm going back to work at Virgin. It's never going to happen. He may have said that.
He's not going to go back to the Breakfast Show.
I've not, you know, whenever I speak to him every single day, either on email or we speak directly, one of the last things I'm going to talk to him is, so what's happening with you then? we talk about much less rarefied things than that. The orange carrot thing, I've no idea if he's coming. And why would he come back to work up against this iron horse anyway?
This is the second
worst possible time to launch a breakfast show now, with you. The first time, XFM. Do we all know XFM's launch day?
the day after Diana was killed. They went to their radio show. The same overnight, and they went ahead. You've got to say hats off to XFM. Well, I mean, they went, instead of saying, I think we'll postpone it a week, nope. When the entire world was in shock and reeling and you couldn't move for coverage, XFM launched. Yes, they did. With some champagne. They had some fruitage. Yes, they did. This is also from the wonderful CD. This is just very soothing. Who knows? Who knew this had words? Listen to this. This is Julie Covington. Songs you didn't know had words, but here's the original of it. Only a little bit. Here we go. What a lovely song. Oh. This is all courtesy of the great Mr. Sam.